STR podcasts are made possible through the generous donations of our listeners. To support STR today, go to str.org and click on Donate in the upper right-hand corner.
This is the show your pastor warned you about.
Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason, and I'm so glad you joined me today. Looking forward to 3 hours of conversation, reflection, and giving you a piece of my mind on the most important things that we can be thinking about. And yes, I think thinking is critical, even though feeling is part of it. I don't know if I've said this before on the air regarding Christianity. Pardon me. But emotions are what makes life delicious, and careful thinking is what makes life safe. And so I think that applies to our walk with God, and that is that we seek to have warm hearts and sharp minds, I think, as J.P. Moreland has put it. So our hearts are warmed by what we know to be true, that our characters are changed by discovering reality and our and God's place in it, and our place would be under God's place. Oh, goodness. 1-800-227-5278 is the number if you'd like to queue up for conversation here on Stand to Reason. And if you're in the 714 area code, you can dial 754-4150. Looking forward, by the way, to our third hour together. And I will have in studio Holly Ordway. I should say Dr. Holly Ordway. She's written a book, Not God's Type, A Rational Academic Finds a Radical Faith. It's a wonderful story. I just finished reading it this morning, so it's fresh on my mind. And indeed, I can say fresh in my heart because it's a touching saga of an atheist coming to know God in a very real and powerful way without leaving her mind behind. So it's a great conversation for us here on Stand to Reason. That'll be our third hour. So please be sure you stay with us for that conversation. As you're queuing up, 1-800-227-5278, with anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics and values and religion, I'd be glad to answer questions if I can about the Bible or about engaging someone else about your own convictions about the Bible or about Christianity or broadly about reality. And if you disagree with me, of course, you're welcome to call in too and share that disagreement. My goal here is to demonstrate that Christianity is worth thinking about. And the only way to do that really is to have you, or I should say one of the best ways to do that is to have you call me with what you're thinking about, and then let's think together over the phone a little bit about these critical issues. So as you're queuing up, I wanted to relate to you something that happened to me a couple of nights ago and that has two different messages, I think, two different lessons, if you will. I spoke, and I'm just going to be more general here for the sake of the audience, just because I don't want to implicate any individuals. I spoke in a church in Southern California on the issue of moral relativism. It was a wonderful audience, a wonderful church, and things went well until the final question of the Q&A, which was completely off topic. And the question had to do with, could God really be good if there were countless eons of death and suffering before Adam and Eve, and God is responsible for this kind of thing? What's the reflection of this on God's character? Now, some of you might recognize immediately this question is going to come from somebody who believes that the universe and the earth is young, and I respect that belief, by the way. I don't share it, but I respect it, and I'm glad to have conversations about the issue. And it is a question asked of somebody who doesn't share that belief, by the way, and that would be me. And since it was at the very end of the Q&A, and it was unrelated to the topic, and I had the sense that it would really detract from the point of the evening, I simply begged off on the question. But then the gentleman who asked the question, I was going to say accosted me later, but actually the question that he first asked was friendly. So he approached me afterwards as the crowd is dispersing and people gather around for private questions and interaction. And I'd had a couple of like that already. And then he pressed me on the same issue. Now, generally when I am asked a question like that, which is an implicit challenge on my own view, I don't mind the question, of course, because there are a lot of people who don't agree with what I agree with and believe, and they wonder about it, and they want to test it to see if it's sound, or they want to test it over and against their own contrary view, and this to me is fine. However, there are some people that use questions like this not because they want to get an answer, and not just because they want to challenge your belief with a question. That's Columbo number three, if you're familiar with the tactical approach to having conversations that we teach here at Stand to Reason. But they take it actually a step further, because a question or two of challenge is fine to give someone something to think about, or to use our terminology, to put a stone in their shoe. And this is our method. The idea is let me just ask this question to raise this issue, and maybe it'll get you thinking about something. You and I disagree about this, so let me just ask this question, offer you a thought, and I'm going to trust you to chew on it for a while and see if it doesn't make sense to you. And that's an entirely legitimate approach. We teach that. So I don't mind even using questions to confront an idea that one thinks is false, but it's an entirely different idea to use questions in that way, which turns out to be a question after question after question, in which you're grabbing a person by the throat and you're going to drag them to the ground and keep strangling them until they cry out for mercy. And this is the way it went for me last week. Because once I gave the answer, there were more questions of a more challenging nature and an accusative nature. And before I knew it, here I am in front of a number of people that are waiting to talk to me, and I'm fighting for my life. And I don't mean fighting for my life in the sense that I am overwhelmed by with an inability to give a reasonable response to the challenges. But I am fighting for an opportunity just to be able to give my answer and move on to other questioners, because these two, a husband and wife, were not willing to give up the floor. And it was, frankly, I think, embarrassing for my hosts. And it was troublesome for me, and I had to control myself to keep from getting impatient. And then when finally I was able to break away with some force, as I recall, then it was the big handshake and the big Christian smile, which I don't mind. I like the handshake and the Christian smile if it's not an example of passive aggressiveness. So a big handshake and a Christian smile, friends, I'm keeping this somewhat anonymous because I don't want to use this as an attack towards a person, but an example of something happened that is a lesson for us. If we go out and thrash somebody, it doesn't make up for the ill manners by giving a big God bless you and a smile and a big handshake or hug at the end, like we really are brothers after all, if we have not been treating someone with the kind of respect and care that is characteristic of brothers during the conversation. That's kind of my point. So now here, there's two applications here I have for this. One is tactical. My policy, as you know, is to try to give someone something worth thinking about. It is not to persuade them in the moment of a deeply held view that they have contrary to mine. I can't persuade them in the moment. It's not going to happen. I mean, for realistically, I'm not saying God can't just hit somebody with a lightning bolt and all of a sudden they're transformed. It just doesn't happen that way. And so that's why I am content with putting a stone in their shoe, having them hobble away, annoyed in a good way, as I say, about something that I have said that gets them thinking. I expect that I can't do the whole job in 1 5- or 10-minute conversation, so I'm just going to do a small bit. I'm just going to give them something. Chew on this. By the way, tactically speaking, people are less... they're less resistant to small points than total worldview transformations, all right? So instead of trying to change their mind in one conversation, especially if their views are strongly held, tactically what we do is we go after one piece of their view and we offer a thought that gets them thinking about that. We try to make a reasonable point, which is exactly what I tried to do in my response to this gentleman. And I'll tell you the detail in a moment because there's a substantive issue I want to talk about here, not just a tactical one. But from a tactical perspective, let me just say this. Regardless of your convictions on the age of the universe, if you think your view is true, you are not going to advance your view effectively by being obnoxious in the way you converse with other people about your view. If you're offending people, if it feels to the other person like you're trying to throttle them and drag them to the floor, they are going to resist with everything they have because no one wants to be dragged down. People, I think, don't mind being led by a thoughtful idea. In fact, I know that they don't mind in general because I've participated in conversations where I've been on the giving and receiving end of thoughtful ideas that have made a difference in their life and my life as time went on. That's tactically sound. So if you want to make a difference in somebody's life, you don't take too big a bite when trying to deal with a deeply held conviction that the other person has, whether it's contrary to Christianity broadly or whether it's an internecine discussion that you are having with other Christians on differing theological viewpoints. So that's the first point. It's a tactical one. And I hope that no matter what side of the discussion you find yourself on this particular issue, that you take this tactical point seriously. Because I think both people both sides of this discussion believe that they're in possession of the truth, and they believe that the truth matters. I mean, some truths matter more than others, but let's just say this matters. So if it matters, then it matters how we try to persuade people of the truth that matters. And this is where the tactical considerations come in. That's the first point. The second point is the particular point that I made to the gentleman, which was meant to be a stone in his shoe to get him thinking. Because the observation I made is that the way the question is asked is loaded. And the question was asked something like this. If you believe in an old earth, that means there was death before Adam's fall, and that means there were countless millions of years of agony, pain, decay and destruction and suffering that are completely senseless that God ordained to go on before he decided to make man. So how can this show that God is a good God? Now, by the way, I think it is a fair question. But what I wanted to point out is that sometimes the way the question is asked loads the question in one direction, and that was the case. So I wanted to just isolate one item, and that is pain. The presumption is that pain is an evil thing, and therefore a part of the fall and unbecoming of God. Let's just set the fall thing aside for a moment. But pain is an evil thing and unbecoming of God, and on the old earth view, pain existed before the fall. Apparently, in this gentleman's view, pain came after the fall. So I asked him a question, Columbo style, and the point of my question was, so I'm going to let you know up in advance where I'm going with this. And then so this will help you, I think, to just know how to consider the point that I'm making. The broad point is people like me who disagree with people like the gentleman do so for reasons of principle. That is, we see problems in a view and the problems are significant. And therefore, we are not inclined to simply jump on a bandwagon because one whole group thinks that this is the only way to think about it. I want to hold theological views that have the least amount of problems, biblically and otherwise. And so I have reasons that I think are significant to consider that give me pause with regards to the young earth view, even though I have a very high view of Scripture, and I don't think anybody can fault my commitment to the gospel. Or you can if you want, but if you know me for a while, you know that, well, I'll let you answer that question for yourself. But I do have concerns, and so I was raising one of those concerns here that is one of those things that gives me pause about the characterization that the gentleman made about what he thought the old earth view amounted to. And all I did was isolate the concept of pain. So the question there is, here now is it an argument against God's character that there was pain before the fall? And of course, if there's pain, there's suffering. The two go hand in hand. Suffering is a kind of pain. And egregious pain is suffering. I guess suffering would be pain that goes on for a while. If you just get a stick with a pin, that's a pain, but it's not really suffering. But if you're stuck over and over again, then the pain endures, and now you're suffering, but these are connected. So I'm asking the question of what is the purpose of pain physiologically? And I asked the gentleman, if I took a sharp object and pressed it into his skin, would he feel pain? Yes. Would he recoil from the pain? Yes. What is the purpose of the recoiling? The purpose of the recoiling is to protect the body. So the pain is a signal that allows our bodies to recoil from potential damage. All right, that pretty straightforward. Now here's my question. Is that a design feature of the human body? And of course, this would apply to anybody, but we're talking about human beings. Simple question. And the gentleman said yes, he thought it was. And I agree with him. The neurophysiological response of pain and our reaction to it is very complicated. It's designed. It has every evidence of being designed, and I think, and we are both Christians here, and so we believe that, and so there's no problem acknowledging the obvious. But you see where this is going now. If pain is part of a response system that is designed to protect the physical body, then God is the one who designed it. And if God made it, it's good, not bad, even though it hurts. Part of his reaction was, well, it hurts, so it's bad. Well, it's bad experientially if what you're referring to is just simply the experience of the feeling, but it's not bad morally, which is what the original objection entailed. So if pain is not bad morally in itself, maybe it's now moved to egregious proportions because of the fall. But if it turns out that the pain is a design feature that God put in human bodies to protect us from harm, God designed that thing, then we can't call pain in itself bad. And if pain in itself isn't bad, then it can't simply be trotted out as an argument for the young earth view, because on the old earth view, pain came before the fall, and God would never do that because God is good. Now look, maybe that argument is flawed, but it's worth thinking about. It's the kind of thing that I think about that gives me pause when I hear these kinds of characterizations that suggest that the old earth view offers an unbecoming kind of characterization of God's personality, of God's goodness. I think there's more to it than that. That's all I'm saying. And I'm just giving one little example here. This is just one stone in the shoe, and I wanted the gentleman to consider it. And that's the kind of, and I have dozens of those things that relate to the question of the age of the universe. And these are all things that give me pause as a follower of Christ who's trying to think carefully about the big issues, and not just kind of adopt a partisan theology because there's a certain popular reading of Scripture that a lot of people like. I'm going to try to make sense of it in light of everything that I know that I think is justified. And that includes understanding the scripture and taking into account how that speaks to my day-to-day experience of reality. Because after all, that's what truth is, isn't it? It's when a statement or a belief fits reality. And so if I can't take the statements of the scripture and try to match them up with the way I understand reality on a day-to-day basis, I cannot demonstrate for anyone, including myself, that the scripture speaks with accuracy or with truth. Because truth just is that correspondence between the claim and the way the world really is. And I think one of the most powerful arguments for the legitimacy of Christianity is because when we take the Christian worldview writ large and we match it up against the reality, we have a wonderful fit. It makes sense of the world. And so in the micro issues then, like these theological questions, I'm simply trying to do the same thing. Something to chew on there, friends. Getting to your questions after break, I'm Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason.
Now you can take Stand to Reason with you anytime and anywhere you go with the new iPhone app. Free on iTunes, you can listen to the radio podcast, watch the video podcast, check the STR blog, and access timely and practical resources on many subjects, including the latest edition of Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letters, and much, much more. You can also follow Stand to Reason on Twitter and Facebook through the Connect section of the new app. Designed by the group that has created iPhone apps for some of the largest Christian organizations and churches, you will be pleased with the clean layout, the great features, and the functionality of the new Stand to Reason app. And did we say it's free? So download the app today through iTunes and start carrying STR with you everywhere you take your phone. And let us know how you like the new Stand to Reason app by posting your review on the iTunes STR app page. It's just one more way that STR is seeking to increase your knowledge, wisdom, and character.
Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20 that we are all ambassadors for Christ. This verse has guided STR's mission from the beginning, helping you and other Christians to grow as ambassadors for Christ. And it's why we created a new series of booklets called The Ambassador's Guide. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. Our newest release in this timely series is on the subject of Islam. Written by STR speaker Alan Schliemann, this booklet is a vital resource to prepare you with the knowledge and wisdom to better understand the Muslim faith while sharing Christ in an effective manner, a skill that will be especially valuable in the changing world at our doorsteps. Other topics in the series include the New Atheists and Postmodernism, with other subjects coming out this year. To order your copy of The Ambassador's Guide to Islam, or any title in the Ambassador's Guide series, call 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason, or order online at str.org.
Greg Kokel giving you a piece of my mind today, as I do every Sunday from 2 until 5. I almost said 3 until 6, and I haven't done 3 until 6 in about 15 years. Funny how that sticks, isn't it? You know, I can remember my phone number when I was in junior high, and I have to pause to remember my phone number now. And I don't know anybody else's phone number because everything's speed dial, right? Isn't that weird? CL24159, Clearbook 2. 4159. That was my phone number. Can I remember that? Don't anybody call that because you're not going to get me. That was a long time ago. Let's go to callers here. Speaking of calling, and in Colorado, John, welcome to Stand to Reason. Hello, John.
Hey, great to talk to you. Thanks for all you do.
You're welcome. I'm actually getting on a plane on Tuesday for Colorado Springs, so get to visit your great state.
Yeah.
What can I help you with today, John?
I've got, I know a guy seeking some advice. I'm curious how you would frame your opinion or your position here.
What are you facing?
His wife is pregnant and found out recently she's got, stage 3 cancer.
Okay.
And, turns out the it can't be treated, I guess.
It can't be treated?
It can't be treated without terminating the pregnancy first.
I see.
So,
okay. So if I understand this correctly, she has to have an abortion before the treatment can ensue. Is that it?
Correct.
Or is it that the treatment, if pursued without an abortion, would bring harm to the child?
Probably the latter.
All right, because the distinction is important to me here, and I presume you want my advice with regards to the ethics of the decisions they're facing. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah, and I'm going to say right up front that this is more difficult challenge, but it's made less difficult when we get some things that are clear in our minds, all right? And these aren't things, John, that I suspect, given the fact that you've called me, that you're in doubt on, but I want to say this for the rest of the audience so they see how we work this out. The way that we don't try to answer this question is based on how we feel about things or how or something along that line. What we first have to start out with is a clear understanding of what's at stake. So we have a mother whose life has intrinsic value. And we have a child whose life also has intrinsic value. They are both human beings made in the image of God. And under other circumstances, taking either life would be an equal crime because in both cases, we are willfully destroying the life of an image bearer, all right? So however, in my view, however we make this decision, we have to make the decision in light of that reality that there is intrinsic value. Now, I'm going to introduce one other concept here. Given that the mother's life and the child's life have the same intrinsic value in virtue of the fact that they're both human beings, there is a second kind of value that is in play. And the second kind of value is what might be called instrumental value. That is, what value one individual serves for other people. So when we think of a... we have a waiter at our restaurant. The waiter has transcendent value, being made in the image of God, but they have instrumental value in the fact that they can wait. They're waiting on our table, so they're serving us in some valuable way. You got that concept there?
Sure.
Yeah, we're not reducing their value to the servitude, but we're simply saying that they're two different kinds of value. Now, in the case of the child shares the intrinsic value with the mom, so it's a tie there in terms of value. But in the case of instrumental value, the mother serves additional purposes in the lives of other people that are significant. And so, if you had, let's just say we are faced with this terrible choice of saying the mother or the child, and the nature of the circumstances was one or the other. Then I think what we'd be morally obliged to do is to protect the life that had the greater value. But when I say the life that has a greater value, I don't mean greater intrinsic value because they share that. It's just that the mother has additional value, that is a role that she plays in other people's lives, her husband's life, maybe her other children's life, her community life, etc., her family life, that is real value. And so this changes the equation a little bit. Now, I have to apologize for using words like equation, because I know it sounds like at this stage I'm thinking it very abstractly and very mechanically and very arithmetically, by counting up value. But at this stage, it's necessary. This is exactly what's necessary. We have to look at what the facts of the situation actually are in order and not be moved by our emotions to make the best decision, though emotions are deeply involved. So when I come to a question like this, I have these things in place, that the mother and the child have transcendent value, and I have to make my choice in light of that, that they have equal transcendent value, but also that the mother has an additional value that is meaningful to a whole lot of other people that the child doesn't have. So in light of that, if push comes to shove, if push comes to shove, and I have to decide between the two, it's one or the other, then my decision would be for the thing that is the greatest good. Even though I know some harm will come of it, I still am obliged to choose the greater good, not the lesser good. And that would have me favor the life of the mother. Now, we're just putting that in place. So those are kind of some game rules. So let's look at the specifics here again. I do not think that it is justified, from what you've told me, for someone to kill a child in order not to potentially harm the child by some medical procedure that will happen to mom. I mean, this seems to me a little bit odd when you think about it. Mom's going to undergo a medical procedure that will probably harm the child, so let's kill the child first. Then we are taking active steps to bring harm to the child. The alternative would be to leave the child alone, negatively, and positively, to do everything we can to care for the child, given the child has transcendent value, but then do whatever we can to care for the mother as first priority. And if it turns out, in order to save the life of the mother, the child's life is lost indirectly by the action taken to save the life of the mother, then that's a consequence that we have to live with. But it's not something that we directly caused. Does that make sense so far?
Yeah, it does.
Now, philosophers have a name for this. It's called the law of double effect, and basically it means that sometimes you do a good thing and you know a bad thing is going to result. But the good thing is done. There's more complexity to this, but I'm just giving you a quick sketch. The good thing is done for its own reasons, because it's the better thing to do. And in a sense, you live with the consequences that you know will result, but you're not trying to cause. You're not trying to cause the death of the baby. You just know that that's going to be the consequence, and you can't avoid it.
Right.
Notice in this circumstance, if no action is taken, it looks to me like both are going to die. I don't know the details of this particular circumstance, but that's my suspicion.
Right.
And so what we're trying to do is at least save one life here, and the life that can be saved, it seems, is the mother's. Now, it may be, by the way, that the mother might say this, and this is completely within her, in a sense, jurisdiction. The mother could say, as mothers do, I'm not going to get the treatment because it will harm my child, and I am going to give life to my child. And I am going to suffer the consequences myself. Maybe start treatment after the birth. Or not take treatment and suffer death to save my child. Many mothers have died on behalf of their children. And that is a completely legitimate response. Although, you know, if I were the wife's husband, I wouldn't want her to make that choice. Because then there's multiple losses here. You know, it's not just one life for another. It's the loss of that life in my life and in my daughter's life and in the lives, my daughter's lives and in the lives of many others. So this is part of the equation that has to be taken into consideration. So I think what I'm going to do, John, and this is an issue you can revisit on the podcast, and so can your friends if they'd like to. I'm going to leave it here because obviously I can't make the decision for them. There are some personal calls here. But the decision must be made in light of the ground rules, in my view. Ground rules being that both lives have intrinsic value. The second one is that mother's life has instrumental value that the child's life does not have. And this pertains to the relationship she has with other people right now, including her husband. And the third one is that the mother can choose to sacrifice on behalf of her child, and that's her choice. But what you can't do is you cannot sacrifice the child. You can't just go out and kill the child because you think the child is going to die anyway.
Right.
That would be a
direct harm.
That would be exactly. That would be a direct act of harm towards the child, which I think would be unconscionable.
Yeah.
Under the circumstances that you just offered me.
Right.
All right, John.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Yeah, I'm glad that it, you know, maybe gets a start in the thinking for you. And there's an there's an internet, a website that Melinda has just posted for me. It's called benotafraid.net. Benotafraid.net, no spaces. And okay. From what I understand, this is a website that is meant to help people with ethically difficult pregnancies. I mean, I'm not going to endorse it. I don't know. Just check it out. I don't know anything background, sure. But Melinda just put it up. So it's a resource that you might look at, and you can make assessments on, you know, yourself based on what you great. Find there. All right?
Okay.
I appreciate the call, John.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Greg.
Yeah, all the best. And these are difficult circumstances, but it doesn't mean when you have difficult circumstances in which deep emotions are involved that there are not guidelines that are available to us to follow to make the decision. And I hope this is coming across loud and clear for the rest of you. Shall we go to break right now? Yeah, let's go to break a little early. Then we'll come back to Ed in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, who wants to know if there's a relationship between philosophy and science. And I have very strong opinions about that. And we'll do that in just a moment on Stand to Reason.
This is Greg Kokel here with an invitation for you to join with other listeners who are making a difference. You know, Stand to Reason relies on the financial support of listeners just like you to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Their gifts keep Stand to Reason providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Through STR, Christians can learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and winsome. I think you'll agree that our world, our cities, our neighborhoods need effective Christian ambassadors. Well, if you want to make a difference like this, would you consider supporting STR Radio today? You can make a gift to STR by calling 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, or you can donate online at str.org. You know, training Christians to think more clearly about their faith is changing the way Christians engage others about their values. And you can play your part in STR's mission by calling 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, or donate online at str.org today. Thanks.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Basic training for your mind, ladies and gentlemen, that's Stand to Reason. And it's just basic, by the way. It's just we're trying to lay a foundation here, and we hope and expect that many of you will go beyond this as you do your own thinking about your own convictions. And take advantage of, reading authors that we present here or others that you're familiar with to go deeper and richer as a Christian. And by the way, the last call demonstrates that this is not just academic, highfalutin, ivory tower reflections. But when we are faced with difficult, deeply weighty moral decisions, it can be helpful for us to have more than just emotions to go by to give us confidence that we're making a good decision. And incidentally, I know that there is kind of a popular response in situations like we just talked about in the last segment, and the abortion question, and they say, well, you can't judge a person unless you walked a mile in their shoes. I'm not convinced at that at all, because sometimes it's being in their shoes that creates the emotional disturbance that causes you to make bad decisions, morally speaking. And there certainly is a critical and important place for empathy. And sometimes even identification, if you're close enough to circumstances like that, yourself. But if what empathy means is that our emotions rule, and we say, well, we can understand why you do that, and therefore in the understanding of why you'd have the impulse, this somehow gives legitimacy to a morally bad decision. Then we've allowed the wrong thing to take the reins. And sometimes it's the disinterested mind that is the one that has no stake in the matter, that has the tools, you know, to work through some of these difficult things, that is in the best position to offer advice about this. And this is why we say in our material regarding abortion, and that would be Making Abortion Unthinkable, The Art of Pro-Life Persuasion, Scott Klusendorf and I argue that the moral question of abortion is actually, I think, quite simple. It is, there's a simple syllogism, there's a simple logic of the pro-life view that can be demonstrated to be very sound. And what is difficult is applying what we learn to be the right choice. So I am not trying to give the short shrift to the emotional difficulty of doing what's right. However, because it's emotionally difficult to do what's right doesn't mean the issue is difficult. Those are two separate things. Let's go to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and this would be Ed. Hello, Ed. Welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, Greg. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Now, this is the place where you got to be careful driving in the country, right?
I want to run into those buggies. I'm
those horse-drawn carriages, right?
Yeah. So, anyway, I was having a debate online with an atheist, and he made the ridiculous claim, no Christian has ever made a scientific argument for the existence of God. So,
okay.
I basically pointed out that the whole field of natural theology, exactly that, looking at the existence of God from a scientific and philosophical viewpoint,
mm-hmm.
Outside of looking at revealed specific revelation.
Mm-hmm.
Plus also just the whole field of apologetics that I pointed out, just searching for terms natural theology mm-hmm. and apologetics on Amazon returned mm-hmm. like thousands and thousands of books.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave him the definition of natural theology from the beginning of the Blackwell Natural Companion.
Mm-hmm. Blackwell Companion, by the way, is a book. A highly qualified book on philosophy.
Right.
Just so people know, they might not recognize the bib source you're offering there. So.
So his response was, but that's just philosophy, that's not science.
Uh-huh.
Of course, the first response to that is Columbo question number one, what do you suppose philosophy is?
Mm-hmm.
But then the follow-up, which I intended, unfortunately did not have time to do, was by thinking that, what I was thinking was that science is not possible without philosophy,
mm-hmm.
and in fact they're intimately intertwined, and mm-hmm. I wanted to get your take on that.
Oh, no. Well, you're definitely right on that last point. Let me set that aside for just a second and respond to something you said earlier. For people listening, natural theology are those things that we could know about God from natural revelation or general revelation as opposed to special revelation. So we can know a lot, even special revelation tells us we can know from general revelation a lot about God's character. We find that in Romans 1, for example. And so any reflections on the world that give us any clues to the world's maker would fall in the broad category of natural theology. And this gentleman said that there are no scientific arguments for the existence of God. And then he made the other comment about science kind of trumps philosophy. I'll get to that in a second. But the fact is there are scientific arguments for the existence of God if what one means is, and this is where you need to get clarity with him, is there scientific evidence that points to the existence of a personal being outside of the natural universe? And of course, this is what cosmological evidence, the cosmological argument, and the design argument, which are two of the three classic arguments for the existence of God, trade on scientific information in that way.
the cosmological argument that anything exists at all has to have an explanation. And the modern science now is Big Bang cosmology, and so who banged the Big Bang? That's the cosmological argument. So that is tied to science.
Right.
The second one, the design argument, is that we look at the physical world and see evidence of design, and so from that we infer a designer is another scientific argument. It uses the methodologies of science to infer something outside of the natural realm that helps us to make sense of the natural realm. Now, I'm using my words very carefully here because I know where he's going. Or I should say I know where he's coming from. He's using a trump card here, and he doesn't realize it. But I've explained in a careful way how science can be used to make the case for a creator outside of the natural realm. Now what he's going to say is, that answers his challenge. By the way, whether he's convinced about those arguments or by those arguments or not, the cosmological argument or the design or teleological argument, is not the point. He claimed there can be no arguments, and we just say, here are arguments. Now, you can take them or leave them, but they're arguments. So if a person is holding science in high esteem, then science can be pressed into service for this enterprise quite naturally, it seems to me. And this was the case for a lot of scientists in the past. Now something else is going on, and this brings us to the second part of our question. Because he is not just invoking the methods of science here. He is invoking, whether he knows it or not, a philosophical view. Because the minute I talk about God, that is something outside of nature, he is going to cry foul based on what he understands nature to be. I'm sorry, science to be. And he's going to say, well, wait a minute, you're talking about God now, that's not science. Right?
Right.
Okay, notice that he is... I think we just lost Ed here. Ed, you're welcome to call back. I'm going to be talking for a moment here. Notice how, first of all, he has just made your task impossible. He said, give me a scientific argument for God. And then you give him a scientific argument. And he said, but that's not science because it's an argument for God from science. So he's made it impossible for you to fulfill his request by the way that he's structured his approach. But the second thing, is that Ed again?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, what I said just a moment ago, he's actually made it impossible for you to answer by the way he structured his approach. He's asking you for scientific evidence for God, and then he is arguing that it's impossible to do so because the minute you mention God, then it's not science anymore. But more to the point here, what he is doing is he's importing a philosophical notion into this discussion. He, this man, who says that you've got philosophy over there and you've got science here. And he is using his philosophical notion to do his science with. So his philosophy is affecting the kind of conclusions that you're allowed to come to based on your scientific methodology. So here is now the relationship between science and philosophy. I'm suggesting that though he says they're two different things, that his own comments evidence that they're connected because he is disqualifying God based on a philosophy that he's imported to his science. And that's called the philosophy of materialism.
Uh-huh.
But here's the way the structure works. Philosophy covers like four or five different areas. One is metaphysics, and metaphysics deals with the question of what's real. Okay, I mean, it's not very complicated.
Mm-hmm.
Another one's ontology, which is being. Another one is ethics. That's under philosophy. Another one is beauty. That's under philosophy. But another one is epistemology. Now, do you know what epistemology is? Is his name familiar?
How you know what you know?
How you know. Now, let me ask you a question. Do you think your friend thinks that science is a discipline in which you gain knowledge?
I would assume he does.
Sure he does. He thinks it's the only discipline you gain knowledge, but notice that science turns out to be then underneath philosophy. That is, without the philosophy of epistemology, you cannot even know how science works. That's why you have philosophy of science before you have science. So strictly speaking, you cannot even have science without philosophy. Science is a child of philosophy. It depends upon philosophy for its very existence, because the methodology of science, the experimental method, whatever you want to call it, is something that is a philosophic question and not a scientific question to begin with. So he can't get away from the connection, and bad philosophy results in bad science, and a lot of scientists are bad philosophers, and your friend is one of them. Because without even realizing it, he's importing a metaphysical philosophy of materialism that is distorting the kinds of answers that he can come up with. So, I mean, there's a whole lot of stuff going on there. And again, this may be one of those questions you want to listen to again, Ed, on the podcast.
Yep.
Your friend is woefully out of line here. And I mean, out of line not in terms of his manners, but in terms of the way he thinks about this.
I've had many encounters with him, and he really does, he throws out anything he doesn't like, no matter how, when I talk about history, suddenly he's anti-science. It seems to me that things, basic things like logic and mathematics, fall under philosophy to some extent, too.
Yes, they do, certainly. And those are necessary for science to do its job. And you also have to have a method of science before you can do the method of science. And doing the method of science is science, but the method of science itself is philosophy. And that's why Steve Meyer, for example, has a PhD in the philosophy of science. He's a philosopher that knows how science works. And this is why he wrote the book The Signature and the Cell and others. But a lot of the people who are most capable of speaking regarding the scientific conclusions that people come up with are the philosophers of science, because they can tell you whether the conclusions legitimately follow from the evidence. That's a philosophical enterprise. It's not a scientific enterprise. So good question, Ed.
All right. Thank you very much, Greg.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for the call. And let's just scoot real quickly to Brad as we do. Two thoughts here. STR.org, you can find a commentary entitled Science, Philosophy's Handmaiden. That's something I wrote that covers some of the material that I just talked about. And Twitter winner for this hour is Greg Fudger. So congratulations, Greg. Let's go to Brad in North Carolina. Brad, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hey, Greg, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. I want to let you know also that I think what you're doing is a wonderful ministry. The Lord has really used you to bless a lot of lives, including mine, so I just want to thank you for that.
You're very welcome.
And I mean this as a compliment when I tell you that what you're doing is very dangerous. And by that, I mean it's very dangerous to the world at large and those who aren't following Christ.
I'm glad to be that kind of threat if I am, so thank you again.
Absolutely. I will one day hope to be the same.
Question on Levitical law.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me make a prefacing statement and then kind of ask you for your advice.
Okay, we're crowding the break here at the top of the hour, just to let you know.
I'll make it quick.
Okay.
Just referencing Mark chapter 7, Romans chapter 7 and 8, and Hebrews chapter 8, all those passages are to me, very, very clear that, the old Levitical law applies no longer. Obviously,
right.
We're under the new covenant with Christ.
Yes.
How would you respond to someone who is from a very traditional background, like a Southern Baptist type background, and still kind of clinging on to
aspects of it, of the Levitical law? Well, here's what I'd say, and I've said this before, and to me this is a nice, clean way of characterizing it, but it does raise problems. I think if you think about it, though, it makes a lot of sense. The Levitical law is part of the Mosaic law, all right? I mean, so that you have the larger Mosaic contract. A contract is an agreement. It's made between two parties. Now, who was the contract, the Mosaic contract, made between? Who are the parties? As you understand it, Brad.
Between the people of Israel and God.
And God. And when this contract is repeated in Deuteronomy, you say, God says, I brought you out of the nation of Israel. I mean, to Egypt. And so now you're mine. And so now I'm making this covenant with you. So a contract is between two parties. And the parties here were God and Israel. not God and Gentiles. And so whatever provisions that we find there are legally binding on the parties to the covenant as long as the covenant is in force. So the question of whether Levitical laws apply today to us is no on two counts. On the first count is because the Mosaic contract was never made for us. It was made for Jews. Are there things we can learn about God and about good living and all that other stuff? Yes, certainly. It is there for our instruction as we look back on it now, but it is not for us to apply as such. Secondly, it's not even for Jews anymore. The New Covenant, Jeremiah 31:31 says this, God says, I will give a new covenant, not like the one you broke when I brought you out of Egypt, but a new one, and we know what that new one was. It was the one initiated by Jesus at the Last Supper, secured at the cross, and then launched at Pentecost. So now, as New Testament Christians, Gentiles, we were never under that covenant, and now New Testament Christians, Jews and Gentiles alike, are under a totally new covenant anyway. So as to the specific demands of the Levitical covenant, the answer is no, we are not under that. Well, we got it in there, Brad. I hope that helps. And we're just up against hour number two. Please stay with us here on Stand to Reason. I'm Greg Kochel. Welcome to our show, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Greg Kochel. The show, of course, is Stand to Reason. That was my number one child there. How old was she when she did that? She was 15 months old. Well, now she's five, and, of course, she's been on the show a number of times, but thanks for that contribution. Show is Stand to Reason, and I'm your host with you every week here. Welcome to the show. Those of you who just came on board, I encourage you to pick up the first hour. We had a lot of good callers, and one dealing with a difficult moral question about a mother's life is in danger, and she's pregnant with a child, and that's a tricky issue. We talked about that, and I think in some ways it might be helpful if you've wondered about that question and whether the Levitical law is applicable to Christians right now, and the relationship of philosophy and science, all that first hour. And my opening remarks were about a tactical issue that came up when I was speaking last week. So I just recommend that to you. Go to str.org and you can get the podcast there. Go to iTunes. You can get the podcast. We'll send it right to you on a weekly basis. And I hope you benefit from that. This hour, I want to start out. Of course, the lines are open. We have people in the queue. The number 1-800-227-5278. If you're in the 714 area code, that's local to where I'm at here in our KBRT studios in Costa Mesa, 754-4150 is the number. I wanted to talk a little bit about some confusion that comes up on occasion. And I am sometimes amazed when I hear what some people think that I said. Because I can't imagine having taught something and trying to be careful and thinking that I'm, you know, more clear than many, that people could come to the conclusions about what I said that they do. Although in some areas I've gotten used to it, and I know if I speak on this topic and say this thing, people are going to hear something else. I found out that somebody recently thought that I taught that if you understand the truth of Christianity, then you don't need the church anymore. So this person wasn't going to church and was telling his mother that I said it was okay. I can't for the life of me figure out how anybody would get that impression. The life of the community for the Christian is the local church. And that's where we get our instruction, and this is where our relationships are built, and this is where we get our encouragement, and this is where our community life is experienced. So, and this is where we make our contribution, by the way. Normally, there are exceptions to this. My contribution is broader than my local church, but I do make a contribution there. And so should you. So I don't even know where that came from, but just for the record, that's not what I believe. There's another thing that I heard last week, or it was a response I got when I was in Cairo, Egypt, working with a group of wonderful Christians there, with Focus in the Family Institute there, Middle East. And this comes up, it did then, and it comes up generally, frequently, when I talk about the concept, never read a Bible verse. That is, you don't isolate verses and try to apply them to your life in isolation or claim promises in isolation, because it may turn out that the promise that you think you're claiming isn't yours to begin with, and so you're just purloining a promise. You're stealing it. And even if you're not purloining a promise, you may be misunderstanding the teaching of the text. I think I mentioned last week that one of the questions that was asked me while I was in Egypt is, what is the application of Exodus 14:14? And in fact, that's what she asked me directly. What is the application to my life of Exodus 14:14? And it stymied me a little bit, because this is the verse applying to the time when Moses was at the Red Sea and the people are there gathered against the Red Sea, and the Egyptian army is thundering down upon them, and they think that all is lost. And God simply says to them, the Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. And this, the gal said, was a promise that she quotes. In other words, she's under pressure, and she claims the promise of Exodus 14:14, the Lord will fight for me while I keep silent. Well, this, of course, is not a promise to anybody but Moses under those circumstances. Now, one could draw from that verse that there are times when God will fight for us in our silence, but it's not a command at any time for us to be silent, trusting that he will fight for us. And in fact, if I look in the New Testament, Jesus said that when you're in a difficult situation, you will speak because the Holy Spirit is giving you the word. So there's no enjoinment to, enjoinder. Is that the right word? One is not enjoined to be silent in that circumstance. He is enjoined to speak, trusting that God would work. So neither of these things, well, I should say the Exodus isn't a promise. Rather, the promise for the Christian is in the New Testament. It seems quite the opposite. But as I was thinking about this conversation I had in the evening at a party with the gal who brought the verse up, it suddenly occurred to me that part of the problem here that I was running into with Christians who wonder then, when I say you can't steal a promise, you can't isolate a verse like this, and then they think I'm saying that the Old Testament has no bearing on the Christian life. This would be one of those crazy jumps. I never said that. But this is the way they see it. So it is, if I can't take any verse I want for me, then I can't take any verse for me. And, of course, that isn't what I was teaching at all. And I'm scratching my head trying to figure out, how do I communicate what I really mean here? I do really mean you can't steal somebody else's promise. But that does leave open the question of, how do I read the Old Testament then? And it turns out that many Christians, I don't know most, but I would say most in my experience, when I see how pastors use the Old Testament and I see how Christians use the Old Testament, turn out to misuse it. And part of the confusion, it seems, is because we have chapters and verses. In other words, the Bible is broken down into discrete units. And we don't, it doesn't really occur to us that these discrete units, like chapters and verses, didn't come about until about the 13th century, 700 years ago. It was not given in discrete units like Exodus 14:14 that we isolate and then claim for ourselves. It was an entire account. So you have the book of Exodus. No breakups, paragraphs maybe, but you don't have chapters and verses. So the thing was meant to be read as a whole, or at least understood as a whole. Or the individual incidents taken as a whole, were meant to be understood, and conclusions drawn from it. And so I think this is the first problem. If we want to read the Old Testament accurately, our first line of activity in so doing is to think of the whole thing, not the discrete units. I'm not suggesting that there aren't individual verses that might have direct application to our life. I think there are. By the way, Proverbs is written that way. Proverbs is about how life works in God's world. And it is meant to give us discrete aphorisms, little sayings that help us to understand the way life works so that we can work along with the natural rhythms of life as God has established them. All right? But most of the rest of the Old Testament is not meant to be taken that way. And so if we're going to study it for our application, we have to see what it was intended to do. Some of you have heard my characterization of the Christian worldview, that is, the view of reality that Christianity holds, can be outlined by five words. And there's a natural flow to these five words: God, man, Jesus, cross, resurrection. And here I mean resurrection in the ultimate final sense. The end of history. God, man, Jesus, cross, resurrection. In other words, God created man, and then there was a problem, and so God set up a rescue plan that culminated in Jesus on the cross that determines what happens at the final resurrection. But I want you to notice something about the time distances between those five words. You have God, Genesis 1:1, you have man, Genesis 2 and 3, and you have Jesus, Matthew chapter 1. In other words, the entire rescue plan that culminates with Jesus' arrival takes up the whole of the Old Testament, save for three chapters. And in fact, strictly speaking, it's 11 chapters that are outside of the scope of the rescue plan, because the rescue plan is described in summary form in the first three verses of Genesis chapter 12. So you have there what's called the Abrahamic Covenant. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on this right now, but I just want to point out that the Abrahamic Covenant, in which God calls Abraham and he determines to make a nation out of Abraham, which nation he will protect. He gives them a land, he increases the people, he gives them a government, a governing constitution, if you will, and he protects them for the purpose of, verse 3, Genesis 12, blessing the nations of the earth. Now, the ultimate blessing for the nations of the earth is Jesus. And Jesus is the provision of the new covenant. But the outline of the rescue plan is right there in those three verses. Everything that follows falls under it. So whenever we go to the Old Testament, we are always reading over the shoulder of a Jew, as it were, about an account that fits in a broader category of the outworking and unrolling of God's rescue plan for mankind. And when we look at individual occasions of God working, it is appropriate for us to ask first, what is the big picture? What does this have to do with the outworking of the rescue plan, the Abrahamic Covenant? I'll give you an example. The story of Joseph. Now, I had somebody tell me not too long ago that their pastor told them that this was the point of the story of Joseph, and they wanted my opinion about it. And they said, as you walk through the story of Joseph, who is sold into slavery by his brothers and eventually exalted to the number two most powerful man in the civilized world at that time, next to Pharaoh, that Joseph, every time, the problem with Joseph is Joseph depended on his own capabilities. And the more he depended on his own capabilities, the lower and lower he got, until finally he abandoned his own capabilities and he trusted in God, and in so trusting, then God exalted him out of the depths and to the top. And she said, what do you think about that? And apparently the pastor thought this was the point of Joseph's story. And I said, well, I know this account fairly well. And there's almost nothing in the account that fits your pastor's sermon. Because quite the contrary, Joseph was faithful at every point. He was faithful with Potiphar's wife, for example. He was faithful when he was in prison. He was using his gifts faithfully and he was trusting in God. In fact, when Potiphar's wife went after him, he said, I cannot sin against God and do this. And this cost him his freedom because that's what put him in prison, his righteous action. So it was quite the opposite in Joseph's life. You see, the pastor had this sermon in his mind and he was looking for a proof text. And there it was in the life of Joseph. But of course, you could just read the life of Joseph and you can see that it doesn't work that way. What might be gathered from the local look at the life of Joseph is that here is a man who was doing the best he could to be faithful in difficult circumstances, and every time he was faithful, things got worse. Now, is there a lesson in that? Yeah, sometimes faithfulness does not result in temporal blessing. Is that true? You bet your life it's true. But not only that, every time he was faithful, things got worse. Is that true for us as followers of Christ? Sure. Now, it turns out that Joseph was rescued and exalted. You know what's kind of curious about his exaltation? Is that it was two things, the sins of his brothers that were central to the series of events that led to his exaltation, and the sins of others that were central to his exaltation, and the fact that he was faithful in going downhill every time, that was central to him going uphill on the elevator, instantaneously from the bottom to the top. Now, these are all excellent observations from the text that have application to our lives. Notice I'm not just isolating one little verse and saying, okay, here's the promise for you. I'm looking at an account of a man that God used in a powerful way, and I'm looking at what happened, and I'm asking if there are some patterns here that seem to make sense for us as Christians. But that's not the most important thing about what happened to Joseph, because notice we're looking at the story of Joseph. We're not asking the question of why the story of Joseph is included in the account to begin with. Because we always have to ask the question, is what is going on here with regards to God's covenant promises to Israel? And at this point, the only covenant he had was the covenant with Abraham. So what's going on? Well, when we look more closely, or actually when we've dropped back and look more broadly, I guess is the best way of putting it, we see something else entirely going on. God promised to make Abram a great nation. And he was going to use that great nation then to reach the world with the message. Not much detail given there. So what happens? Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, 12 sons, and the 12 sons in Canaan are starting to intermarry with heathen. This is not good for the future nation of Israel, all right? And not only that, there's tough times coming. A famine's on the horizon. Now, the people don't know this. And what ends up happening through the sins of Joseph's brothers, Joseph finds himself in Egypt, and through a series of events in which he is faithful and things are getting worse, finally God exalts him to the number two position in Egypt, and he is able to make a provision so that when the famine comes and the people of Canaan are starving, including his dad and his brothers, they are able to make their way to Egypt and not only survive, but flourish. In other words, what does God intend to accomplish in the big picture through Joseph? He is fulfilling the Abrahamic covenant. He is protecting his people. He's causing them to be fruitful, to multiply, to be a great nation, which he will then eventually bring to the land. That's the big picture. And notice how Joseph ends the account in the book of Genesis. He looks at his brothers who are now reconciled with him and he says, you meant it for bad, but God meant it for good. What was the good? The big picture. The salvation of Israel and ultimately then the salvation of the world, as from the loins of Abraham all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Is there rich opportunity for application there? Absolutely. Without distorting anything. Without proof texting and grabbing promises that aren't ours. Without trying to make a sermon fit into an ancient text where it doesn't belong. We read it. We see the big picture. We ask the right questions. And then we make application to our life. And I think that's the way that Christians use the Old Testament, or ought to. Coming back to your calls here in just a moment, I'm Greg Kokel.
Now you can take Stand to Reason with you anytime and anywhere you go with the new iPhone app. Free on iTunes, you can listen to the radio podcast, watch the video podcast, check the STR blog, and access timely and practical resources on many subjects, including the latest edition of Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letters, and much, much more. You can also follow Stand to Reason on Twitter and Facebook through the Connect section of the new app. Designed by the group that has created iPhone apps for some of the largest Christian organizations and churches, you will be pleased with the clean layout, the great features, and the functionality of the new Stand to Reason app. And did we say it's free? So download the app today through iTunes and start carrying STR with you everywhere you take your phone. And let us know how you like the new Stand to Reason app by posting a review on the iTunes STR app page. It's just one more way that STR is seeking to increase your knowledge, wisdom, and character.
Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20 that we are all ambassadors for Christ. This verse has guided STR's mission from the beginning, helping you and other Christians to grow as ambassadors for Christ. And it's why we created a new series of booklets called The Ambassador's Guide. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. Our newest release in this timely series is on the subject of Islam. Written by STR speaker Alan Schliemann, this booklet is a vital resource to prepare you with the knowledge and wisdom to better understand the Muslim faith while sharing Christ in an effective manner, a skill that will be especially valuable in the changing world at our doorsteps. Other topics in the series include the New Atheists and Postmodernism, with other subjects coming out this year. To order your copy of The Ambassador's Guide to Islam, or any title in The Ambassador's Guide series, call 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason, or order online at str.org.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason, and just a postscript on my opening commentary, because I'm going to bookend it here with Exodus 14:14. Which says, the Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. Now, do you see how this fits into the big picture I was talking about just a few moments ago with the Abrahamic covenant? This verse isn't about the Lord fighting for you, necessarily. I mean, there are times he can do that. It's about God rescuing the Jews from imminent destruction, or what appeared to be destruction. He said, stand still, be quiet, I'm going to take care of you because I have made a promise to your father Abraham. This is just the outworking of that promise. So again, we look at the local circumstances, not only on its own merits, but also at the big picture, as God is working out the rescue plan for the earth through the nation of Israel. By the way, if you want more information on that, we have a teaching on this that is, you know, I did it about 15 or 20 years ago, so my voice is probably higher and squeakier, and I'm talking way too fast. You're welcome to get this from Stand to Reason. A few years back, Melinda said, let's dust this off and put it in play. I wanted to clean it up and make it really pretty, but she said, no, let's just do it because it'll take you too long to fix it. It's called The Bible Fast Forward, and this is what I do in these 10 weeks of instruction, is to kind of go through the big picture, and there's a workbook that goes with it, 100 pages. You can PDF it and print it out and download it and everything. So, That's available to you. Okay, let's go to our callers now. I'm just looking at what I got here. Wesley, welcome to Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel, hi.
Oh, hi, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, very glad. Glad to
do
so.
You kind of caught me in a kind of precarious moment, so I'm trying to run to my car right now.
Okay.
I had a question for, I've been listening to some time, and once again, I want to thank you for your show. I am a Reformed confessional Protestant, I have heard you, and I know that you mentioned that you lean more toward maybe Reformed soteriology.
That's right, exactly. I'm not confessional myself in that regard, but on that issue, sovereign grace, I'm pretty convinced that's the biblical view.
Right. After listening to you, and I, you're always thoughtful in your considerations, I wanted maybe to have you help me and others understand your position on the age of accountability and original sin, because okay. As leaning more toward, I guess, Reformed theology, I'm trying to think for the life of me how you come up with the position for the age of accountability. And
okay,
I listen to you, and I know you're intelligent, so I maybe I'm missing something.
Okay, there are two issues here. One just based on reflection. I mean, if you just simply reflect on it, I think it's clear that, first of all, we as adults, we understand we have moral obligations. Okay, and there does seem to be a developmental stage before which we don't even have the mental capabilities. We have the capacities, but they are not yet capabilities to be able to think in moral terms. So moral actions don't even seem to apply in those circumstances. So, you know, I have a little girl, so I've got a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old. The 5-year-old knows right from wrong. It's really clear that she has those categories in place functionally, though she can't do a whole lot with them right now. They're very basic. But the 2-year-old, I'm not sure. And certainly when she was 1 year old, this didn't even enter into her mind, just like a whole lot of other complex ideas that we aren't able to understand till later. And so it seems to me that one who cannot even comprehend the notion of moral behavior is not engaging in moral behavior. That's kind of my simple reflection. I could be mistaken on this, and maybe people disagree, but it just strikes me as that's reasonable. Now, if at one stage, at one age, there is no comprehension of moral behavior and therefore no moral behavior, either good or bad, there's just, fussing and wedding and that kinds of stuff, and then it's somewhere down the line there is conscious moral behavior in which there is virtue and vice and true moral guilt, there must be some point at which you cross over the line. And I don't know what that is, but there, in principle, there must be a point. So in terms of my reflection on the nature of things, that's one reason that I hold to the age of accountability. But there's another one, and this is scriptural. It always helps if you can have a scriptural reference to kind of support your natural reflection. Although, in my view, it's not always necessary, because I think that God has given us the capability of understanding lots of things about Him, including morality, without having special revelation. And indeed, it's hard to imagine how we could be held responsible for immoral behavior if we don't already have an intuition that allows us to grasp that. And I actually think that this is the arguments why we believe that there must be a God that grounds such a thing. But so all of these, I think you can know some of these things without God. But I'm thinking about Isaiah chapter 7 here. And this is the famous passage, and this is how I know how to locate it, the one about the virgin shall give birth. Verse 14, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin will be a child, bear a son, and she'll call his name Emmanuel. So this is the verse that we hear at Christmas time and the virgin birth, etc. But the next verse says, now in this particular case, there is a historical circumstance that is being addressed here. Okay, so it looks like a prophecy that kind of has, it points far away, but also points directly in front of us as well. I don't want to gauge that question right now. I just want to gauge the point of the next verse that relates to our question. He will eat curds and honey at the time he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. So there it seems to be an acknowledgement by the prophet. There is such a time when you are able to refuse evil and choose good. I have a note I've written here, CF Nehemiah 8:2. So let me see. Let me see if I can find Nehemiah 8:2, because there's something there as well that might relate to this. Let's see what I got. Nehemiah 8:2. Then Ezra the priest brought the law before the assembly of men and women, and all who could listen with understanding on the first day of the seventh month, etc. So this is when the people return to the land, and I don't have the whole account in front of me, but just that phraseology seems to suggest that there is something called the age of accountability. So that would be my thoughtful and scriptural justification for the notion.
Okay.
How's that sound?
I had a quick follow-up question. Would you agree with or disagree with the idea of the concept of the imputation of the guilt and corruption of Adam to all of his prosperity?
Yes. Yeah, I would agree with that because that's orthodoxy. If you disagree with that, you're outside of classical Christianity. By the way, it raises problems, but I'm just saying, I guess just because it's outside of classical Christianity, that alone would make it true.
Sure.
But, I mean, I think it is true because I believe in classical Christianity, but I'm just simply making the point that this isn't one of those things that we can just kind of toss out if we don't like it or we don't understand it. The alternative is some form of Pelagianism, which was a discussion between Augustus and Pelagius in the 4th century. Yeah. Did I get the names right? Yeah. And so Augustus was on the side of orthodoxy and Pelagius was out there somewhere. So it's not a good thing to reject this theologically. I mean, this is very thin ice theologically if you want to just toss this out. But it does raise problems. And in fact, I've mentioned this before, but this is the thorniest theological problem that I face as a Christian. And I have said that with regards to the defense of the Christian worldview and message, I think the most difficult issues are theological. They are not outside challenges on Christianity, but they're rather the internal theological issues that are conundrums of sorts. And I think this is one of them, because it raises the question of how is it that one could be actually culpable for some behavior that someone else committed? And there are different ways to answer that. I read a response just recently that was as satisfying to me as any of them. And I'll tell you where I got it. I got it from Millard Erickson in his fine tome on Christian theology entitled Christian Theology, which, by the way, is a book everybody should have in their home, because you need to have a theological book. You need to have a book that really means to cover the basics of theological issues. And I think this is a really good one. You give a nice broad perspective, and he offers a solution. And what he says is this. He says that the sin of Adam, because he identifies that it is orthodoxy to believe in original sin and the impact that we are fallen when we're born.
Right.
But we don't seem to be culpable for our own behavior before the age of accountability, because we haven't done anything wrong. And there is this thing we see in the Great White Throne Judgment, where the judgment is based on specific things we do wrong. The books are open and we're judged according to our deeds.
Right.
And I just have this conviction for other reasons that those who die before the age of accountability are ushered by God's grace into heaven. So what do we do with it, original sin for those? I had said, well, I think it's an act of sovereign grace that God forgives that, because the accounting of the judgment is based on individual deeds which they haven't committed. So there's a possible answer. But Erickson has a different one. It's related, but it's a little different. He says there is actual culpability regarding Adam's sin, but the culpability is not, in a sense, applied to one's account until the child does its first act of willful sin, having attained the age of accountability. And the act of willful sin then brings in the culpability of Adam's sin and all the rest of our willful sins that follow. I thought that was an interesting way of looking at it. But keep in mind, some of these things are speculative, and so we're trying to do the best we can to understand them with the limited revelation that we've received. The thing that I want to be most dogmatic about, I guess, is the fact that there is original sin, and that this is orthodox under all forms of Christianity, Roman Catholic, Orthodox, Protestant, you know, all kinds. This is inside the pale, as it were, and rejecting original sin puts us outside the pale. I know that raises some difficulties for some folks, including myself, but that's kind of the way I'm working with it.
Right. All right. Well, I just wanted to call in and get your clarification on your view of that. So I appreciate your time. I look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Yeah. Okay. I appreciate the question and thank you for the call, Wesley. Melinda says she disagrees with nearly all I just said. Just for the record. Of course, that's Melinda that's disagreeing. So, you know, you consider the source. But but that surprises me a little bit. We've never talked about this. Oh, so you don't believe in original sin? Yes. Okay, so now she's giving me the look. Well, I'm not an idiot. All right. So okay. We'll have to have this conversation later. But just so you know that the enforcer and I don't agree on everything. All right, let's go. Let me look at the clock. Should we go to another call? All right. 1-800-227-5278. No, we don't have enough for more callers. Let's get David right now. Victorville, California, and David.
Hey, Dave. Hey, Greg. How are you?
Good. Thanks.
Hey, I don't know if I got, I don't think I caught all of it, but you were saying that you're not too sure or you don't believe necessarily in a literal 6-day creation. You're not a young earther.
I'm not a young earther. The word literal is ambiguous. So what I'm going to say is I don't believe that the earth was created in consecutive solar days.
Okay.
Because the word literal can mean a number of different. You look in a dictionary, and most words have multiple literal definitions, as opposed to a figurative use of it.
Fortunately, the Bible isn't so ambiguous, because I think clearly the Bible, and very easily, a young earther such as myself can prove, without a doubt, that the earth was created in a literal 6 days. And all we have to do, simply, is go to the book of Exodus, chapter 8, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy.
Right.
6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. And,
right.
Verse 11 says, "For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that in them is." Well, proof of the fact that we still have a literal 7-day week is the fact that you observe it. So your observance of the literal seventh day or the 7-day week proves, without a doubt, that the earth was created in a literal 6 days. Because,
okay, David, you made your argument there. It's pretty clear. Although it's ambitious to say it proves without a doubt, because there still are a lot of people that seem to doubt it, and they have some reasons for it. Are you interested in hearing any of the reasons why I might doubt? That's the way to take that passage.
That's what I was asking. What would be your doubt?
There's a couple of reasons. For one, the seventh day is not a literal 24-hour day. That seems obvious because we're in that seventh day now, thousands of years later.
And I would disagree with that.
All right. What you have to do, David, is listen to my argument here for a moment,
and then you're welcome to disagree if you want.
You're welcome to disagree if you want, but I'm not here to persuade you of my view. I'm here to show you that there are reasons that people would have that would cause them to doubt that there are 24-hour solar days in view there in Genesis, and therefore then would cause them to take a second look at the Leviticus passage that you think is so clear. And I was just asking you a moment ago whether you wanted to hear that or not. So I need to hear whether you want to hear that or not.
Oh yeah, sure. No,
okay,
no, no.
Good.
I'm just suggesting that we need to make a correlation between the two.
No, I understand, but you're doing more than suggesting, so that's okay. Let me just give you some of the thoughts that I have, and here they are. And the first one is the seventh day is not a 24-hour day because the book of Hebrews indicates we're still in the Sabbath rest. Secondly, when you look at Genesis 2, it seems reasonable, let's put it that way, to say that the sixth day is not a solar day either, considering what took place on the sixth day. I know there are counters to this by people, but they're just not at all persuasive to me. And it strikes me that a reasonable person can see the point that a lot of things happen on the sixth day, and not only naming all the animals, but when God creates Eve, Adam responds in a particular way. He says, "Now at last." And so it suggests that maybe he's aware that he is missing a suitable helpmate for a while, not just for an afternoon. And so with that in mind, I might think, well, then, gee, and the first couple days don't have a sun, so they can't be solar days, and so maybe something else is going on there. This brings me then to the Exodus or Leviticus passage that you cited. It could be understood as being one in seven literal days, and that's the way it's being taken, and that's the way it's being applied, but it can also be proportionality. Since there's one in seven, and here I'm going to put the word, the quotes around the word days, because I have questions as to whether they're solar days, since we see a one in seven pattern there in Genesis, then the one in seven pattern is transferred to the work week, as it were, and applied in that way. Now, that strikes me as a possible way of understanding the would you say Levitical or Exodus passage? I forgot. Is it
Leviticus?
Leviticus. That seems like a possible way of understanding it, and if it's a possible way of understanding it, then it's a possible way of understanding it without pulling tricks on people. So these are some of the reasons why I'm not so quick to agree that it is obvious and without a doubt that these days are 24-hour solar days. I have a lot more reasons, too, but those are the reasons that speak specifically to your challenge.
Sure, and I would just say to you that when it comes to a day, a month, a year, and so forth, we have astrological reasons for these days.
Yeah, I understand that.
Yeah, a day simply is the Earth rotating on its axis.
That's one definition. Another definition of day is daytime.
Daytime is another literal definition
of day.
Well, but you're not letting me finish my point. A month is the revolution of the moon around the sun or mm-hmm. around the Earth.
Okay.
In one cycle.
Mm-hmm.
A year is a cycle of the Earth traveling around the sun in one cycle.
That's one definition of it, right?
Well,
I don't know that month has more than one definition. Year and day do.
I'm not talking about abstracts. I'm talking about actual. A year time is not. I'm talking about an actual year is astrologically defined by the Earth traveling around the sun. That's not just one way of looking at it. That's the way to look at it.
Okay, well, see, I'm going to end with this reflection, and part of the problem is just what you said. That is the way of looking at it. It is very clear to people who use language that the word day can mean a couple of different things, even used literally, and so we have to look at the context. Now, you're persuaded it means one thing, and I'm thinking it's meaning something else. All right, fair enough. The difficulty for me is the assertion that there is only one way of looking at it, and I just don't find that to be the case. I could even be wrong in the way I look at it, but you know, when there's this kind of dogmatism, there's only one way of looking at it. And someone seems to be presenting alternate ways of looking at it that seem to be legitimate, and they're just dismissed out of hand, then it seems that we have little grounds for conversation. But you've made your point, and I appreciate it, and I got a chance to respond, and I'm glad you gave me the opportunity. Let's go to break, and I'll be back in just a moment here on Stand to Reason.
This is Greg Kokel here with an invitation for you to join with other listeners who are making a difference. You know, Stand to Reason relies on the financial support of listeners just like you to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Their gifts keep Stand to Reason providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Through STR, Christians can learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and winsome. I think you'll agree that our world, our cities, our neighborhoods need effective Christian ambassadors. Well, if you want to make a difference like this, would you consider supporting STR Radio today? You can make a gift to STR by calling 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason, or you can donate online at str.org. You know, training Christians to think more clearly about their faith is changing the way Christians engage others about their values. And you can play your part in STR's mission by calling 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason, or donate online at str.org today. Thanks.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith.
And these three self-directed studies will cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Greg Kokel back with your Stand to Reason. By the way, coming up next hour, please don't go anywhere. Holly Ordway is going to be in studio. In fact, is already, but she'll be on the air with me at the beginning of next hour. Get this for a title of a book, Not God's Type, A Rational Academic Finds a Radical Faith. I finished it this morning, and it was wonderful. And so we're going to hear her story when we start hour number three together. I'm looking forward to that conversation. Let's quickly go to your calls here in our final segment of the second hour here, or first hour for some people. I got to just quit using that. This hour, final segment of this hour. Let's go to Jeff in Southern California here. That would be Fullerton. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing fine.
All right. Now, well, I just wanted to briefly challenge what you have said or seem to have said in the past about Jeremiah 29:11, for I know the thoughts that I think toward you, saith the Lord, thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you a future and a hope.
Right.
Well, there are several points I'd like to make. Number one, you seem to, we may agree more on the meaning of the verse than I think, I'm not sure, but you seem to say that it was for Israel and not applied to Christians.
Well, I don't seem to say that. Jeremiah seems to say that, because at the beginning of the chapter, it says, now these are the words of the letter which Jeremiah the prophet sent from Jerusalem to the rest of the elders of the exile, the priests, the prophets, and all the people.
Okay,
and then it repeats that in verse 4. So this is a private letter to Israel, and then one would take the particulars of this letter as being a private directive or a private communique to Israel.
Sure.
Actually, Judah, strictly speaking, here in Babylon.
Well, that's fine, but one point I'd like to make is that there's many Christian pastors and such that disagree with that interpretation.
Yeah, and I think it's I acknowledge that entirely, which is causes a deep sadness for me.
Well, and okay, if I could make my points though, first of all, about Israel, in Exodus 20, verse 1, it said, "And God spake all these words, saying, I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt," talking to Israel. Mm-hmm. Then he gives the Ten Commandments. And I'm sure that we could all say that the Ten Commandments are for us today as well. Not that we're saved by them, but that we live by them and they are prosperous to us.
Actually, so, just the way you put it, I wouldn't agree with it without qualification. That's
okay.
Another discussion. But do you?
Okay.
Do you hold to keeping the Sabbath on Saturday?
No, but Jesus specifically sort of contradicted that in his New Testament.
Oh, well, I don't know where Jesus contradicted the Sabbath.
Well, he said man was made for the Sabbath and the Sabbath for man. But we're getting it off into another point.
Okay.
I'm not here to discuss the Sabbath.
Fair enough.
So even if it was correct that it was for Israel, which only for Israel, which I don't believe, the fact is that we can apply some things that were given to Israel to Christians, for example.
I agree with that, by the way. So
yeah.
You don't have to give me examples, because in principle I do agree. The question is whether this letter, whether we can isolate sentences and apply it, I think, willy-nilly to believers, just simply because my people is a phrase that's used in it.
I understand that. But you also said don't take a verse out of context.
Correct.
If you read further, it says, verse 12, "Then shall ye call upon me, and ye shall go and pray unto me, and I will hearken unto you." Verse 13, "And ye shall seek me and find me when ye shall search for me with all your heart."
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is a universal principle that can be applied to those today, even though it was given in words to Israel, such as many other verses in the Bible. You also said that there are not New Testament scriptures to support it. I believe there are many New Testament scriptures.
Wait. Okay, let's slow down here a little bit. You stopped reading too soon. And I will be found. Hold on just a minute.
Sure.
We can have a conversation here.
Absolutely.
We got a little time. And I will be found. This is your next verse. When you search for me with all your heart, and I will be found by you, declares the Lord. I will restore your fortunes. I will gather you from all the nations, from all the places. I have driven you, declares the Lord, and I'll bring you back to this place where I sent you from into exile. So these are all and so these are all connected together. Would it be appropriate for me to say that money that I lost in the stock market last week will be returned to me, and I will be going to Israel based on this promise?
Well, I'm not saying that.
Well, how is it that you can apply the one without qualification and not the other? That's
well,
my
I'm
question.
Well, I'm not applying one without qualification.
Well, you just said that it was...
I believe all three of those verses are for the Christians. And also, if you want to use 14 in a spiritual sense, they can be applied. I'll be found of you, saith the Lord. I'll turn away your captivity. So, I mean...
Well, this is the very question.
They can have different meanings, literal meaning to Israel as well as spiritual meaning.
Okay, fine. This is the entire problem. So far, all you've done is just asserted the other view that I disagree with, that we can just go ahead and grab passages and spiritualize them and make them apply to us, when in fact they weren't intended to be done that way.
Well, I'm not doing it in isolation. As I said, I believe there are many New Testament scriptures that support that idea that's given in Jeremiah.
Well, if there are New Testament ideas that support that say something similar, then we should use the New Testament ideas to address Christians and not take the verses that sound similar that are specifically written to Jews about a unique situation, which is why he said, I will take you from the lands where I've driven you and I'll restore your fortunes.
Well, I believe that we can take both because it says all Scripture is given by inspiration of God, is profitable for reproof, instruction, righteousness, etc.
All right. Now, let me just observe something here. You think we can take both simply because all Scripture is inspired and profitable for teaching, reproof, correction, for training in righteousness. I agree with your use with the passage out of 2 Timothy, but it seems to me you're arguing that since the Scripture is useful for teaching, then that gives us the liberty to abscond with other people's promises because they're simply God's words.
I'm not saying that we should abscond with other people's promises. I'm saying that they are promises for us as well, as indicated in the other verses.
Okay, well that's
and other examples of God speaking to Israel, mm-hmm. David, Moses, different. Others that can be applied to Christians.
Okay, you want to spiritualize verse 14 when in fact verse 14 is talking about a matter of fact that has to do with fortunes and geographic locations.
I'm not negating the meaning of it by spiritualizing. I'm adding to the fact that it can apply to Christians as well.
No, I understand. You're not negating the meaning to the people. You are just you are just changing the meaning for Christians.
No, not at all.
All right.
Because verse 11, I believe, applies to Christians as well, but just because it says something in addition to that in another verse, like returning to the land, does not negate the verses that go before.
All right. We're at a complete impasse here, Jeff. That's all I can say, because I'm not dismissing you at all. I'm just saying that I don't know how we can have a further discussion, because what you want to do is take these passages and just... And apply them in kind of spiritualized way when it feels like it's appropriate to apply it. I don't know how else to put it that way. I want to start with the context and stick with that and get the bigger meaning that seems to be applied by the author, and you want to spiritualize these and apply them to Christians. Pastors do that all the time. I agree with you. I think it's tragic. Because what ends up happening is people end up quoting promises that aren't theirs and then also developing theology that is unsound from the Scripture, and they never get the big picture. So I had the last word on that one, but I don't know what else to do in this particular case. Thank you for the call. Scott Stonehouse is our a Twitter winner this hour. Good for you, Scott. And couldn't have happened to a nicer guy, by the way. Do we have time? Let's do this quickly. We're going to go to Paula in Missouri. Paula, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, Greg. Good to talk to you.
Thank you. It's nice to talk to you, too.
Thank you. I have been in a discussion with some followers of Judaism, mm-hmm. some Jewish people, and they are willing to make, I guess accusation may be kind of a strong word, but it kind of is, against the Holy Spirit mm-hmm. and Stephen as a martyr in Acts chapter 7.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, they found what they said are several lies coming through Stephen by the Holy Spirit, and in particular in verse 52, is the one that's kind of a tougher one for me, and mm-hmm. I wanted to know your thoughts on it, like how you might answer this accusation.
Mm-hmm. His summary here as he goes through the kind of the history of Israel's rebellion is,
yes.
Which one of the prophets did your fathers not persecute, and they killed those who had previously announced the coming of the righteous one, whose betrayers and murderers you have now become. And you who receive the law as ordained by angels, and yet you do not keep it. So the charge is, apparently, that it seemed like there were some prophets who didn't, rather, that weren't persecuted. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Here's the way I would respond to this. There is what Stephen is giving in Acts 7 is a characterization, a summary, if you will, of the history of Israel. And the summary of the history of Israel is not attractive, because as God repeatedly acted in mercy and in revelation to them, the people repeatedly rebelled. Just think of the divided kingdom. In the northern kingdom, you have 20 kings, and not a single one of the kings was a good king. In the southern kingdom, you had 20 kings, and a few were good, but not that many. And this is why the northern kingdom was dispersed, and the southern kingdom was sent into captivity. And so, taken as a whole, Stephen's account is a sound one. I think what he's doing here is he's using a standard literary device called hyperbole. And when he says, which one of the prophets, just like Jesus saying the mustard seed is the smallest seed, but it grows into the biggest plant. Well, neither of those things are true if taken to their literal exactness, but that wasn't the point he was making. And so what you have to do when you read literary accounts like this is you have to think of the point that the person is making instead of straining at the precision, exact literal precision of some of the words. And I think that's probably the best way to respond to this. I suspect, though, that your detractors won't be satisfied by that, but it is a normal way that we have conversation about things. We speak in generalities.
Right. Okay. So you're saying the general message is still accurate. Yeah, they're kind of straining at the words, saying there are prophets.
Was there an individual? Right. But listen, in the Old Testament times, Israel, they were thick with prophets. Most of them were false prophets, and they were telling the kings what they wanted to hear. Remember Elijah with the prophets of Baal. You know, you've got the prophets of Baal and the prophets of Ashtoreth, and a lot of those prophets, there were hundreds of them, but a lot of those prophets said they spoke for the Lord. And you can go to the time when Judah was about to be dispersed from Babylon. The prophets for God spoke properly, and they told the people what they didn't want to hear, that there was destruction coming. And the other prophets said, no, the Lord hasn't spoken to him. He spoke to me. And so for the righteous prophets were then persecuted. Jeremiah would be an example. So what I'm trying to kind of give you a picture of is the vast majority of the prophets were false prophets, but the true prophets of God were, on balance, persecuted for the truth. And the pattern that Stephen is describing is an accurate characterization of the pattern of Israel. And that's why I think if you strain at the language, which one of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? And if they were to say, Micah, you know, say, oh, all right, okay, I'll give you Micah. Maybe he would have said that. I'll give you Micah. You're missing the point, though, aren't you? You know,
yeah.
That's the kind of the way I think that he would have responded in that situation. And by the way, don't quote me on Micah, because I don't know if he wasn't persecuted.
Yeah,
I'm just grabbing a name.
Yeah, the ones that they gave were Moses, Samuel, and Nathan as being ones that didn't get persecuted. And then there, you know, I've seen some discussion about Moses. At one time, he thought he was going to be stoned.
Yeah, I don't know if. Yeah, I put Moses in a separate category.
Yeah, not even a prophet.
Well, he was a prophet, but he's just in a whole different thing. Samuel was the first prophet of Israel, and I think actually it says that in chapter 3. And so when you're thinking of the office of prophet, Samuel was the first. But anyway, you can work with that, okay? Straining at a gnat and swallowing a camel, to use Jesus' phrase. But, Paul, I appreciate your call, and I hope that's helpful for you. Next hour, coming up, Holly Ordway. The book is Not God's Type, A Rational Academic Finds a Radical Faith. Stay with us, friends.
I would like to ask you a very important question.
All right, my friends, our final hour together, and it's always fun to be able to have somebody in studio whose book you just read and enjoyed and were encouraged by. Edified's the word. That sounds too spiritual. I just like encouraged. It was uplifting. And sometimes it's only spiritual words that are available. Holly Ordway, chuckling on the other mic there. Holly, it is an absolute treat to have you with us today.
Well, it's a real treat to be here, Greg.
We actually met before. I didn't realize that until you mentioned it when you came to the studio just a bit ago at Biola.
Yes, I'm a student on the master's program in Christian apologetics there, and 2 years ago was my first year, and you spoke to us about bloom where you're planted,
yeah.
And I found those words very inspiring.
Well, I'm gratified to hear that, and you obviously have done this. Is this your first book? And I only ask that because I know you're an academic. You have a PhD in literature, as I understand. Is that right?
English literature. So it's my first published book. I mean, I wrote a dissertation,
right.
But it's on microfilm in some shelves somewhere.
Right. Well, it is a sweet story of your odyssey, is if that's and it's an unfinished story, because it just tells the beginnings, as it were, which are very insightful of the process of someone in your situation, which we'll describe in a moment, kind of just going full course with a thoughtful analysis or a thoughtful reflection on life and reality and the worldview that was presented to you through another follower of Christ, who was your, as it turns out, your fencing coach.
Yes. Which just goes to show that you can be a witness to Christ wherever you are and whatever you're doing. You don't have to be a pastor. You don't have to be a teacher. You just, if you're living out the life of Christ and you're really, and you know him, then that's something people can see and respond to the way I did,
mm-hmm.
no matter who you are and what your work is.
Mm-hmm. But there's more in the case of Josh and his wife Heidi, who we know from Stand to Reason, but I didn't know that they were fencers. And Heidi, I guess, is quite accomplished herself, though she's not an instructor. She's a competitor, as you are now.
And she actually coached them as well.
Oh, is that right? So, but in their case, it wasn't just, in a sense, the life of Christ in terms of standard virtues that was lived out. He was able to do something for you. I mean, just speaking in general terms, we'll get into the specifics of the stories, do something for you as an academic that a lot of other Christians might not been able to do for you as an academic.
Yes, that's true, because he, you know, knew me after having worked with me as a student for a year, knew that I was, you know, very intellectual, very rationally minded, and that when we did have this conversation, that the arguments and the evidence and the details, that was something that I really responded well to.
Mm-hmm.
But I really want to emphasize, there's something that, especially as I reflected on this, you know, the last year, because as I said in my book, I wrote this in a way to capture the snapshot while it was still fresh,
mm-hmm.
of what it was like to make this journey. But as I continue to grow in Christ, I see more and I sort of understand more about some of the things that happened in that journey and the way that, you know, God has done such a transforming mm-hmm. work in me since then. But one of the things that I keep coming back to is that conversation that we had, that very academic conversation, the fact that we had that conversation in the first place, that's amazing, because I didn't want to have that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that could happen was the witness of my coach's character,
mm-hmm.
That I responded to, that I had the Spirit working in me in other ways first.
And you can see that looking back now.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm.
But I really want to emphasize that point, that it was responding to seeing him and seeing Heidi and not understanding it, what I was seeing, but they had something I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And as I look, you know, as I look at them now, I see, well, I know what I'm seeing. I'm seeing Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, if it weren't for that, the witness of their character, the way they behaved to me, then I wouldn't have ever brought up that conversation in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And I think you referred to it just a moment ago, the backdrop of it is your own beliefs that you brought into this relationship when you took on Josh as a coach for you, as a fencing coach. And fencing would be like with swords,
yes.
Just for those who are really, you know, not up to... Now, is it... I know there's like foils and sabers and then the big broadswords that you whack each other with. Is that the three categories?
Yeah, foil, saber, and épée, actually. Whacking with broadswords is sort of Hollywood-ish. And really do that. We do Olympic sport fencing. It's much cooler.
Okay. Well, it's faster. That's for sure.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, but didn't they actually fight with those big swords? I mean, like, who am I thinking of? Like, William Wallace and all of those guys. You know?
Oh, that's not the kind of swords we use in fencing.
Okay.
Think for sabers, think cavalry. And then you'll have the ancestor of sabers.
Okay. Okay, good. So, Errol Flynn, maybe.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
You know, I understand it. This is just a little aside, but, I loved watching the Errol Flynn stuff. And I also was a particular fan of, I'm having a hard time with his name right now, but it's the guy who played the Sherlock Holmes movies.
Basil Rathbone?
Basil Rathbone. And who then was the sheriff of Nottingham, who fenced with Robin Hood. And my understanding is that he could have dispatched him in a second because Basil Rathbone was quite an accomplished swordsman.
Yeah, from the movies I've seen him in, he looks just very, very skilled.
Yeah, I think he was actually a competitive fencer or went to the Olympics or something like that. This is kind of the recesses of my memory. But that's not the most important thing of our conversation. I wanted to go back to the way you opened the book because I think it's a superb opening. And it was the first thing I read, and when I read it, I just had to set it down because it was such a satisfying opening. It's not quite up there with it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, but it's one of those openings that I think really, in a lovely way, draws the reader into your story. And here's the way you start. This book sets out to do what might seem to be a straightforward task, to recount the experiences of a few months in my life in which I walked away from atheism and entered into Christian faith. Nothing is ever as simple as that. What a wonderful beginning. And I, of course, that just drew me right into the book. So maybe that's the best place for us to start. So you started out as an atheist, but as an atheist who had always been an atheist, apparently, and had never really thought about anything else.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of people grow up in a kind of nominal Christian faith, which for all practical purposes is atheism. It's a sort of functional atheism. But I didn't even have that. I grew up with absolutely no religious upbringing whatsoever, no Bible in the house. And honestly, I kid you not, the very first time I ever went to church was after I became a Christian. I went to church with Josh and Heidi, and I was terrified, by the way, all those Christians. So really, I think in a way I was as close to being a functional pagan as you can get. And it kind of formed the basis of my worldview that if religion was so unimportant, then how could it be true? If it's just this thing that people do sometimes, like a hobby, it doesn't matter.
And this is your reflection on religion writ broad here, just religious people of all sorts. This is the way it seemed to you, just that this was like a hobby or a club or something that was not deeply consequential.
Right. And one of the things that looking back on, I see as a colossal mistake is, which people make all the time, is to think of religion as being a uniform thing. Well, religions make very different claims. Mm-hmm. Pantheism and Christianity make radically different claims. Mm-hmm. New Ageism and Islam, Buddhism and Judaism, deism. I mean, you run the gamut. These different, you know, quote unquote religions make radically different claims about the nature of reality. So to lump all of them together into religion is basically to put them in a category that says, stuff that makes people feel spiritual and kind of to put a label on it that says not really true.
Right, right. Well, this is an observation I make after I make my argument proper against pluralism, which is the one that you just made, that look at all these religions can't be true in a rich sense because they have contradictory truth claims. Now, one way to get around that is to say, well, they're only true in terms of somebody's, you know, affections. None of them are true in the deep sense. And so you can choose whatever club you want to join. And so that sounds
like
a perspective.
That's the kind of thing that just drove me crazy as an atheist. That I felt that it, and actually I still feel that that's wishy-washy sense mentality. And I don't want anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know, I started out with no religion, and no religion basically equals being an atheist, sort of functionally. And then as I got into college, beginning of college, I think I had a phase where I was sort of vaguely spiritual, and I liked to go walk in the woods and pretend I was celebrating Yule and whatnot. It was a very silly freshman. But then, especially as I went on, that sense of kind of vague agnosticism really hardened into atheism. Mm-hmm. Because if everything, it's really hard to stay in that sense of woo-woo, it's all kind of, you know, fuzzy faith feelings if you actually think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't want anything to do with something that would just make me feel better.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, honestly, if atheism is true, I want to know it. It would suck, now that I think about it, because you look into the abyss and you're like, okay, life has no meaning except what I make, and I'm going to die, and everyone else I know is going to die, and that's going to be the end of it. And everything is kind of pointless, in except that I have to strive for meaning. But if that's true, it's true, and I don't want to cling to something just to make me feel better.
Well, this reminds me just a little bit of Anthony Flew, who you may be familiar with, the very well-known philosophical atheist from last century who just recently died but had made a conversion to some form of theism based on the evidence. And his point was that you really have to follow the evidence where it leads, even if you don't like what you find. And this is a similar kind of spirit, I think, that comes out in your book. Well, it's not a spirit. You mentioned it quite a number of times. It's like, I want the hard. I'll have the hard reality, whether I like it or not, even when, as you made discoveries as time goes on, that were contrary to your own convictions as an atheist, you're still willing to bite the bullet and keep moving forward.
And that was something I really had to struggle with on a personal level, because I had, you know, in some ways made my peace with being an atheist. I really had issues with it. There were things I really didn't like about it. But I thought, well, you know, that's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it did have its upside. It meant that I could be the one in charge of my own life. Mm-hmm. I got to decide what was good enough and what wasn't. And so when I started looking at, you know, the claims of Christianity and started recognizing that God is, this really challenged me, and I had to ask myself, look, you've always said that you were an atheist because you think that's what's true. Are you going to bail now, or are you going to stick to what you believe? If you believe in truth, girl, you have to look for it. And that was hard, but that's what pulled me through.
Now, if I recall, and I've got this phrase here, unreflective atheism, in quotes. I think early on you might have used that phrase, if I understand your story correctly. For a while there was this, I mean, atheism was kind of the default position, and it turned out that you had some convictions that, as you look back now, were inconsistent with that materialistic worldview, convictions about morality, convictions about truth itself, and about beauty, and with your love for literature and the beauty that is displayed in the way some people handle language. There was kind of a conflict there as you began to reflect more on what atheism dictated as a worldview and what you were actually believing as a human being in this world. Is that a fair way of putting it?
It is, yes. And I would say that part of the role of apologetics in my conversion was to force me to confront those inconsistencies. It wasn't so much, as I reflect more on it, it wasn't so much that I was argued into believing in God.
Mm-hmm.
It was more that the arguments that I was presented with forced me to confront the inconsistencies in my own worldview, forced me to recognize where I was holding on to things because I wanted to hold on to them, not because I thought they were true, and really made me look at the way these things piece together and say, well, you know what? Atheism, it doesn't really hold together.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to look at that. But then when I did look at it, I mean, if I didn't have any alternative to atheism, well, it doesn't hold together 100%, but well, what are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
But then once I started seeing that there were reasons for Christian faith, for theism, and then for Christian faith, it made me realize I had to let go of some things.
Of course, there's a season in your life now as an academic where you are involved in a community that's very sympathetic to your disdain for religion in general, even Christianity, and these, you know, wishful thinking people who are odd in many ways. Sometimes they're odd for the wrong reasons, but they're human beings, you know. But here's, you got a community. You were really in step with that community, and I don't want people to. And I'd like you to say something about that, but I don't want people to miss that you're a PhD in a in a liberal arts kind of discipline, which of all disciplines is not friendly to the Christian worldview when you figure the kind of people that you traffic with. You were at UNC, right? University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill?
I got my master's at UNC Chapel Hill, and I got my doctorate at University of Massachusetts Amherst.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, so it's like out of the frying pan into the fire, so to speak. And faculty positions then, I know you're teaching out at a junior college down in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
I didn't hold any full-time positions. I dabbled after I got out of academia with my my graduate degrees. I worked in business a little bit. I moonlighted as a fencing instructor.
Mm-hmm.
I did a few odds and ends of things, gave me a little bit of experience of the world, and then I moved back into academia.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
certainly, especially the humanities, where I got all of my academic training, it's very hostile. I mean, and the thing is, it's hostile in a way that it just assumes that hostility is true.
It's justified, you mean?
Not even justified. It's just assumed that that's the way it is. There are no battles being fought in the humanities over whether or not Christianity is true. It's just assumed, kind of assumed mm-hmm. that it's not. Now, I could be overstating a little bit, mm-hmm. and I'm just speaking here from my own experience as a graduate student, you know, doing my master's, doing my doctorate. But it really is not it's not an environment that is easy to have Christian faith in.
Okay, now I'm going to touch on something different here, very unique in your own saga. And I'd like people to hear about this a little bit because it's not what people hear about so much on Stand to Reason. Chaucer and Canterbury Tales and things like it. Why was that significant to you?
Oh, this, I'm really, really glad that you touched on that, Greg, because this was a huge part of my conversion experience. As I alluded to before, my conversation with my coach, Josh, that I saw his witness of his character, but there was something before that that sort of got me wanting to talk about faith in the first place. And that, I have to tell you, if you knew me 5 years ago, that was, or 6 years ago, that was a miracle.
Mm-hmm.
So what really...
I happen to agree with that theologically, so...
It is.
It's always a miracle, but this is a sharp contrast in your case, right?
Because I really had a chip on my shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
But what had happened was I was actually teaching part-time, again, teaching a literature class the year before. This is in 2005. And as I started to prepare my classes, I was rereading this classic poetry. John Donne, T.S. Eliot, Gerard Manley Hopkins. These are men of faith, and their poetry is so profoundly Christian, but they're really great poets. And I put them in my syllabus, and I had studied them because they're great poets. But as I read them, this time, reading them as an adult, with some depth of experience in my life,
mm-hmm.
I had the most amazing experience of feeling like I was tapping into something just electric.
Right.
That these guys, when John Donne writes, "Batter my heart, three-person God, for as yet you but knock, breathe, shine, and seek to mend," I felt like, I don't believe what these guys believe, but there's something
there.
Here. Mm-hmm. And that made me think that what I considered as faith, maybe I was wrong about what faith was.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe, just maybe, these guys had something that was richer and more complex mm-hmm. than what I thought of as faith. And in retrospect, I can see how profoundly I was drawn to that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an attraction. And at the time, it was an unsettling feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I was uncomfortable, but I wanted to see what was this all about? And that was what made me, I think, recognize in my coach, Josh, that, you know, he's a person, I see something in him that I also am drawn to,
mm-hmm.
this sort of peace and this respect, and I think I can talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
But it was those poets that spoke in a way that the power of God was showing through them.
And John Donne is the "No Man Is an Island" entire unto itself, himself. I don't go deep in all of that, you know, and I'm glad you brought this up, though, because it does touch on something that I really care about. And I, for lack of a better word, we have to go to break in just a moment, but for lack of a better phrase, this to me is kind of like, you know, you have the cosmological argument and the teleological argument. These are things that actually played a role in your conversion, and the argument from desire, for C.S. Lewis. But to me, this is a kind of an argument from beauty, and beauty now expressed in language by people who are skilled at it. They're skilled at their craft. And it troubles me when the body of Christ, in general, when it comes to the arts, are not deeply committed to beauty. They are deeply committed to emotional expressions of their feelings, but they don't. They're not artistic. They're not. John Donne, as you just quoted him, you know, the way he writes, people have to think about the way he put it to get the impact of it. It's not a lyric, for goodness sake. It's not a, you know, roses are red, violets are blue kind of thing. It's language used in a powerful way that has to be tasted and has to be chewed as a cut, as it were, you know, to kind of get the substance out of it. And he did it on purpose, but he did it well, and he did it so well that it touched you. And I wish that more Christians who believe in art would take instruction from this. I'm going to get off my soapbox right now, but I'm sure I'm getting the nod and the smile from you, so you know what I'm talking about. There's power in art done well by people who know Christ deeply, and we see the impact of it here. In Holly Ordway's life, author of Not God's Type, A Rational Academic Finds a Radical Faith. By the way, this is not a book on apologetics, though it does have some of those details in there. It's a book on her personal journey, and so it's quite engaging and quite touching at many points. So I commend it to you as followers of Christ. By the way, Melinda and I want to ask, and I know I'm over my time here, but one of the things that meant a lot to you with Josh is that he didn't kind of treat you like gospel fodder. You know, it's like we're gonna win you to Christ here, you know, right away. In fact, it was a year before anything spiritual came up in your conversation. We'll talk about that. But it would strike me that you might feel that it wouldn't be good to give this book to an atheist, like this is an attempt to convert him. I wonder how you felt about that.
Well, I really feel strongly that it's important that people ask questions, and they ask the questions that they have. And I think it really, in my own conversion, it mattered that Josh never, never brought the subject up. He never gave me any books until I asked for them. Mm-hmm. He never quoted Bible verses. I mean, I think in the whole process of our conversation, even after we got going, I think he quoted two Bible verses to me.
Yeah, towards the end, actually, at least in the book.
Yeah, no, I think that's it. That's, mm-hmm. They stuck in my mind because
Fear of the Lord is beginning of wisdom was one of them,
yes,
as I recall.
And then, yeah. My yoke is easy, my burden is light, but yes. Also paired with pick up your cross and follow me. But really, he never pushed that on me. He waited for me to ask the question. And that really, I feel very, very strongly about mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. Now, I know there are times when there are opportunities to say a word that's an invitation. And I think that's the Spirit prompting you, and you should do it. But this book, you know, if an unbeliever picks it up, more power to him. But I really wrote this book for Christians.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the sense I had, actually, and it was sweet for me to read it, and I hope others do as well. We have these available. Check SDR's Facebook page this week to win two more copies of Holly's book. That's the note from Melinda. I'm Greg Kokel with Holly Ordway. I'll be back in just a moment.
Now you can take Stand to Reason with you anytime and anywhere you go with the new iPhone app. Free on iTunes, you can listen to the radio podcast, watch the video podcast, check the STR blog, and access timely and practical resources on many subjects, including the latest edition of Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letters, and much, much more. You can also follow Stand to Reason on Twitter and Facebook through the Connect section of the new app. Designed by the group that has created iPhone apps for some of the largest Christian organizations and churches, you will be pleased with the clean layout, the great features, and the functionality of the new Stand to Reason app. And did we say it's free? So download the app today through iTunes and start carrying SCR with you everywhere you take your phone. And let us know how you like the new Stand to Reason app by posting a review on the iTunes STR app page. It's just one more way that STR is seeking to increase your knowledge, wisdom, and character.
Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20 that we are all ambassadors for Christ. This verse has guided STR's mission from the beginning, helping you and other Christians to grow as ambassadors for Christ. And it's why we created a new series of booklets called The Ambassador's Guide. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. Our newest release in this timely series is on the subject of Islam. Written by STR speaker Alan Schliemann, this booklet is a vital resource to prepare you with the knowledge and wisdom to better understand the Muslim faith while sharing Christ in an effective manner, a skill that will be especially valuable in the changing world at our doorsteps. Other topics in the series include the New Atheists and Postmodernism, with other subjects coming out this year. To order your copy of The Ambassador's Guide to Islam, or any title in the Ambassador's Guide series, call 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason, or order online at str.org.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. My guest, Holly Ordway, that's O-R-D-W-A-Y, and her book is Not God's Type. A great title from Moody Publishers about, and as the subtitle says, A Rational Academic Finds a Radical Faith. And I was just reflecting here, and I'll just make this reflection, and maybe you have something to say about it before I move on with your story, Holly, and that is that it strikes me that there's all kinds of motifs by which people communicate the truth of Christianity because they're different people that receive different things. I think that there are probably a lot more people that are like you, like you were, that would not have appreciated being preached at, as it were, but was deeply responsive to a developing relationship in which you felt the freedom to talk about some of the concerns that were now rising in your heart. Is that a fair way of putting it?
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that, as Christian apologists and evangelists, we have to be really careful of. We've got a bad rap for mm-hmm. a reason. Mm-hmm. It's because I think we too often try to get people in. And sometimes I hear the language of evangelists about, well, I'm going to get them. Oh no, I'm not like big game to be mm-hmm. bagged and brought home. I'm not a notch in your belt. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And I think people know very quickly when they're targeted. And I think people also know very quickly on an intuitive level when their relationship with someone is being used as a means to an end.
A mere means to an end.
And that's why I'm deeply sort of troubled in a way by people who talk about relationship evangelism. Go out and make friends with atheists so that you can bring them to Christ. Now, I really want to honor the impulse there. Mm-hmm. They want to share the most precious thing in the world. They want to share the good news of God in Christ. Good. But if we go and make a friendship, if we go and have a relationship for the sake of sharing the gospel, we are using people. Mm-hmm. We are using them as means to an end. Now, it doesn't matter fundamentally that this end is salvation. They're still feeling like their relationship is being used. And then what happens if they don't come to faith in X amount of allotted time? Mm-hmm. Are they not your friend anymore?
Mm-hmm. And the case with Josh, it was just quite the opposite. It was the basis of a genuine accepting friendship on its own merits, a relationship as coach and student, in this case with fencing, that kind of gave the platform that made it possible to have these kind of, let's face it, intimate discussions about things that really mattered.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that he was my coach meant that I could, you know, respect him as a teacher. I knew that he was patient. I knew that he was, you know, that he could put up with me. This was a very good testament to his character. Mm-hmm. I wasn't a very easy student. I hope I'm a better student now. So I think that's really important. Now, it took me actually a while to figure out that he was Christian in the first place. Mm. I think now I pick up signals a little bit better, mm-hmm. but perhaps the fact that he wasn't like my stereotype of Christians made it that I didn't notice these things that I could have.
You didn't notice in the bad way, in a certain sense,
right? And so
because
I didn't,
they fulfilled a stereotype that you didn't like.
Exactly. I just thought, wow, he's a really, really good coach. He's, you know, teaching.
Demands excellence.
He demands excellence. He doesn't put up with bad behavior. But he's very, you know, he's patient and encouraging, and all of these characteristics of a good teacher and a good coach. And you know, respected my intellect, and you know, chat a little bit about, you know, books and things mm-hmm. like that. And I know he figured out sooner than I did that I was an atheist. Mm-hmm. But he never called me on it. He mm-hmm. never challenged me. And I think that was important. It might be different for other people at other mm-hmm. stages of their life, but I was an adult and I had a, you know, fully formed worldview, and we'd talk about things, and I realized, you know, he's not going to put me down. Mm-hmm. He's not going to make me feel stupid because I don't know certain things, and he's not going to preach at me. Mm-hmm. And that turned out to be the case when we actually did begin to talk.
Well, let's get to that point, because this is an important turning point. And here I want to just quote you, because it's so nicely put. You said, "My atheism was eating into my heart like acid." And, in fact, it surprised you, some of your own reflections on what happened at 911. All these people that you didn't know, and it just distressed you. And somewhere in this mix, you're also reading this beautiful poetry coming from people who had a different worldview than you. Indeed, the beauty was flowing from that worldview, if I read you correctly. And so now you've got something going on, a self-reflection about the poison in your heart, an exposure to this beauty, and then you have an awful tournament in Reno, Nevada, where you were there fencing with Josh and Heidi, and you end up having a conversation through the night at a coffee shop or something. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it really is interesting how God works, because it's kind of, I think the Lord has a sense of humor, because my first real spiritual conversation was in a casino coffee shop in Reno, because they can get venues at casino hotels pretty inexpensively, and I actually committed myself to Christ in Las Vegas because that was where another tournament was. I really do think the Lord has a sense of humor. Mm-hmm. But I had actually gone in thinking I was going to win this tournament. This is embarrassing for me to say in retrospect. I was really full of myself. Sorry, Josh. And I really had high expectations, and I just did so badly. And I remember I tanked a bunch of my bouts, and the ones that I won, I didn't do well. And my coach, he looked at me, he said, "Holly, you did everything wrong." Mm-hmm. See, he was honest with me, right? Mm-hmm. He didn't tell me Josh never told me what I wanted to hear. And you know what? I did do everything wrong. And so he told me that. Mm-hmm. Ouch. But it was true.
So here you are over coffee, licking your wounds, saying, "I don't want to talk about anything that has to do with fencing." And so I'm trying to remember what exactly was the turn here where you end up talking about spiritual things.
C.S. Lewis. Because I forget the context. I think The Chronicles of Narnia might have just come out as a movie. I don't remember the timing. Mm-hmm. But we started talking about Narnia because we both were fans. And I...
For different reasons, though.
Well, we both admired the story and the fantasy. And the thing was...
But I was going to say the distinction was yours was, at this point, strictly literary, because
yes,
you admired the writer, Lewis, because he's in your genre of fantasy, was what you did your PhD work on. And of course, Josh liked the material, but there's another element for him.
Yes. And so I think at this point, the context is important, because I had been sort of dancing around wanting to talk about faith with him for, I don't know, a month or two, and just sort of vaguely edging around it and not getting a Bible shoved in my face. So that was good. And so when we were talking about Narnia, and I said, you know, I like Lewis. I like C.S. Lewis a lot. But, you know, the stuff he says about Jesus, I don't buy it. He says Jesus is either a liar, a lunatic, or the Lord. And, you know, there's another option here. You can say that he's just a great teacher. And Josh kind of looked at me and he said, "Well, actually, no."
That's not going to work.
But then very gracefully, he said, "Well, let me explain what Lewis is talking about, you know." Mm-hmm. And then it turns out I hadn't actually read the Gospels. So I hadn't even looked at them. Mm-hmm. I didn't, this is very, very embarrassing for me to admit as a PhD, I didn't even know that there were only four main Gospels.
Oh, really?
Never underestimate people's ignorance,
Pardon
I say.
Me for chuckling. That is amazing.
Oh, it's dreadful.
But it also says something about, in the industry, so to speak, I mean, here, that the Christianity is so far removed from the reality of that industry that there can be this level of ignorance, even of the Gospels as literature, you would think that there would be an understanding.
It's embarrassing, but I still felt that I could make, you know, announcements about it. That's actually, there's a joke that says that what you learn in graduate school is to talk knowledgeably about books you've never read.
Got it.
Anyway, so that was the opening, and then then I found that he was able to discuss this with me and say, well, you know, did you know that there were these gospels that actually say this? No. Well, I said, well, what about these so-called other gospels? Mm-hmm. He said, well, and he starts, you know, putting out information about the dating and the time. And, mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting. And it just kind of snowballed. And we bounced around all sorts of topics.
Through the night as you're talking over coffee.
Yeah, it was three of us there, Josh, Heidi, and me, and coffee. And we just stayed there for hours because mm-hmm. I was so excited because I was risking something. Mm-hmm. I was risking showing my interest. And I was getting a really interesting conversation as an equal mm-hmm. that Josh really wanted to hear my perspective. He wasn't just waiting to tell me the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just asking questions, challenging me, because, you know, he knew me really, you know, pretty well, and pushing me to think, mm-hmm. but not pushing anything on me.
I like the illustration about the coffee cup, and because at some point you are expressing your doubts about life after death and all of that, and so who could ever know? How could anyone ever know? And he gave an illustration.
And actually, I'm really glad you brought that up, Greg, because this is important. And I think that as I look back now, even past the reflection of the book, look back on this journey, this is important. The illustration was that I had said, well, you know, look at this coffee cup. You know, I have the lid on. It's one of those little portable coffee cups with the plastic lid. And I said, you can't know. Without, you know, you can't know whether there's coffee in it or not. And I said, that's like the afterlife. Maybe there's one, maybe there's not. There's no way to know. Now, notice that already this is a softening of my original position mm-hmm. because I realized that agnosticism was sort of more viable than atheism in, mm-hmm. in this particular context. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, you can't know. And I thought, ah, I've got this, you know, sealed.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually thought that Josh was going to make some sort of, you know, argument about like, well, we have this evidence or this or that or the other thing or brainwaves or who knows what.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, he kind of looked at me, looked at the coffee cup, and he said something that really surprised me. He said, Holly, do you trust me? What? And I thought, well, you know, yeah, because, I mean, this is my coach. Mm-hmm. I take lessons with him without wearing anything. So, you know, I just wear my mask. I don't wear a jacket when I take lessons. On a very visceral level.
By the way, the significance here is that they're poking at each other with sharp objects.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're not sharp. They're not sharp, but they're still 3 feet of steel.
Yeah, there's threat involved, and you trust him not to cut you because you know he can.
Yeah, I know. I trusted him that as my coach, he's never going to hit me. And, you know, and so it really, this was an important question because at a very visceral level, yes, mm-hmm. I trust you. And then he said, well, if I told you, like, if you couldn't see in this cup, but if I told you there was a nice, delicious latte in this cup, would you believe me? And I kind of sort of thought I saw where this was going. So I squirmed a little bit, and I said, well, yes, I'd believe you. You wouldn't lie to me. But I said, but I believe you because I know you.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at me, and he said, well, I know someone who's told me that there's a life after this one, and I believe him. And, you know, it wasn't so much what he said, it was the way he said it, because I had never heard anybody talk about Jesus that way.
Mm.
And this was consistent. This is, you know, later on when I heard him pray, he spoke of Jesus as someone he knew personally, not as a concept, not as like some historical figure that we affirm something happened. And this, to me, speaks to what my conversion really was about. And I, as I've come to know Christ myself more and more deeply, this is so important. I didn't become a Christian just because I had these arguments that convinced me that it was mm-hmm. true. I became a Christian because I encountered Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And I came to know a person. Now, at the time, my encounter with him was very limited. I couldn't handle more than that. And so
your
a lot of it
was Christ, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so in many ways, it was intellectual. But at the heart of it was that Josh was pointing me toward a person, not an idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I accepted, I did encounter that person along the way.
Mm-hmm.
I accepted that he was who he said he was on the basis of intellectual arguments. And then after I became a Christian, after I accepted him, that was when really the incredible more things happened, which was that I began to encounter him myself. I began to know him, because when I became a Christian, I had encountered him, but I didn't know him. Mm-hmm. And I had encountered him. I knew who he was, but I didn't love him. And that was something that came after.
Well, there's a wonderful line that I was saving for the end of the interview along that line. So we'll tease people with that comment, and we'll come back to it, because I think this is really significant, Holly, and very insightful, that what you just said. But we'll come back to that. And can we just skip this break and keep going? I'd rather just have the 2 minutes to talk with you, Holly, because I think this is so valuable. At that same conversation, so there was this very particular kind of appeal, if you will, that you just described. There was also something else that happened that had to do, and the question he asked, that had to do with morality. Do you recall that, about if no one could know?
Right. This was, and this again comes out of the fact that I've been working with Josh for a year, and he knew me. I wasn't just a random person he struck up a conversation with in the street corner. He knew that I had a strong ethical sense. Mm-hmm. Now, in retrospect, did I always live up to that? No. But I definitely tried to do good.
Mm-hmm. And you were, as I recall, you were aware that this is a bit inconsistent with your atheistic worldview. I mean, this is something that didn't quite fit.
It didn't. And I think, I know I mentioned, in the book that it was an unreflective atheism. This is one of the things that I didn't think about, because if I had tried to think about it, I would have been forced to consciously realize that it didn't work. So mm-hmm. I didn't think about it. But Josh wouldn't let me get away with not thinking, mm-hmm. Which is the key. I mean, he knew I wanted to think, so he didn't tell me what to think. He probed me to do the thinking for myself, knowing, because I'm a persistent kind of person, that I wasn't going to let it go. But he asked me, this is in the context of talking about where do we get a sense of morality. And I was pulling out all the naturalist arguments I mm-hmm. could. Well, it's evolved behavior, because we survive better when we all are kind to each other, etc. It's socially, acceptable to do certain things and not to others. Mm-hmm. It's good for the community. And he said, well, if you could do something wrong, if you could harm someone and benefit yourself by it, and no one would ever know, would you do it?
Which is the end around your objection.
Yeah, that was the end run around, for society's benefit. Mm-hmm. And I started to be, to go off and, well, it's better for the society. No. For you individually, no one's ever going to know. But if you individually could do something wrong and benefit by it, would you? And the thing is that there's a part of me that could have said, well, yes, I would, because that would have been consistent with the argument that I was making. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that I was committed to being honest in this conversation. And at the deep level, no, that would be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like I would have preferred to be able to say, oh, I'm only moral because it's in my best interest to do this. But that wasn't mm-hmm. really what I believed. So I said, well, no, I wouldn't. And he said, well, why not? And I didn't have an answer.
Mm-hmm. And there was another question that he made, and I'm just going this direction because it's in your book, and I think it really lays a certain kind of foundation here, because where he asked the question, are you more convinced that murder is wrong than that there's a trash can in front of you? And I asked the same question, something along this line, but I got it from J.P. Moreland, who is also somebody that ended up playing a role in your own thinking as you're becoming a Christian. And the point being that, there are some things that some non-physical things that we can be more certain about than some physical things. Things, perceptions or whatever. But this, what it does is, and this is Lewis's move too, and you mentioned it in the book, is that once you realize, you really lay hold of the fact of morality, you realize, as you mentioned, that you don't keep the morality that you believe is incumbent upon you to keep. And that's the good news and bad news, good news, God, there is a morality, so and now we don't keep it. So what way of looking at the world? I don't mean to be putting words in your mouth, but it seemed to me come together like this, that these different things that you're really discovering explicitly about your world that you were implicitly aware of, now they've got to find a new worldview to fit into.
Yes, because as I looked at these pieces, they didn't fit. They really didn't fit. Mm-hmm. And so what am
Your
I going to do about it?
Atheistic, materialistic worldview, right?
Yeah, and that I think that was the biggest. I think the most important shift was realizing that the objections that I had to faith, those objections didn't hold the way I thought they did, and there were things that my atheistic worldview could not explain, simply could not. Mm-hmm. That this theistic worldview could. It was a better explanation of the way I myself could observe the world working. And for example, very early on, realizing the Christian doctrine of the fall, that actually was powerful in making me think there's something to this, because it's blatantly observable mm-hmm. that the world is both beautiful and really messed up.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful and bad is the way you put it. I like the
beautiful
alliteration.
Beautiful and
broken. Beautiful and broken. There you go. I actually wrote it down because it was a nice alliteration. But it's I think Francis Schaeffer used to call it a man was noble and cruel. But it's the same idea. How do you make sense of this in one's worldview? And Christianity has an elegant characterization of that in a way that resonates, I think, with our deepest intuitions. And this began to make an impression on you.
Yeah, and one of the things I think to hang on to, you know, I think in some ways the problem of evil is not the real problem. It's the problem of good. Mm-hmm. Why do we expect that the world should make sense? Mm-hmm. Why do we feel that it's right when certain things go the way they go? Why is it right that people should live out their lives and be healthy and have wonderful families and children? Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you know, if you look statistically speaking, we should expect people to have rotten lives, mm-hmm. but we don't. And so I think the idea that a good God made the world and that we broke it, it truly really profoundly answers my own experience of the world.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so at the same time, though, now I think that Josh gave you a book by Peter Kraft, and J.P. Moreland made contributions to that. Is that the debate with Kai Nielsen that J.P. had? Is that right?
It is, yes. It was called Does God Exist? Mm-hmm. And it was the debate between Moreland and Nielsen, but the introduction was by Peter Kraft, mm-hmm. and that was really... It really was very, very helpful, mm-hmm. Laying out the pros and cons of belief and not stacking the deck. That was what I found helpful. And I actually wrote in my notebook, I wrote the list of the pros and I wrote the list of the cons, and I went through the list trying to see which ones I thought had any weight to and which ones didn't.
On either side.
On either side, yeah.
Bad arguments for atheism, bad arguments for Christianity, striking those and seeing what you had left.
And what shocked me was that I had anything left on mm-hmm. the Christian side. And so those are the ones that I followed up. Mm-hmm. I really took a pretty rational approach to it to start out with.
At that stage, yeah. Uh-huh. And I guess the Kalam argument was very persuasive to you.
It was, actually. It was, the first step was, for me, was understanding that there is a first cause. And in some ways, I think it was more of a recognition that this just made sense. In a way, I'm not entirely sure that convinced is the right word. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm speaking now from a further perspective on from mm-hmm. when I wrote the book, even. Because I'm thinking that had I approached the Kalam argument 2 years prior to that, I'm not sure it would have made much of an effect. Mm-hmm. But the point was that at that point, I was thinking, I think there's something more to the world. Mm-hmm. I think there's some texture of reality that I'm missing.
So these are all kind of fitting together step by step. The pieces are come together. You have this poisoning experience of atheism in practical terms in your life. You have this experience with beauty with Chaucer and others. You something else, and it's not just beauty, it's beauty from people who are reflecting from a Christian worldview. You have this encounter with this man, Josh, and his wife, Heidi, and it's like your soil's being tilled, it seems, and then you have this kind of philosophical argument for a first cause, which is personal and mm-hmm. not just any kind of cause, and you itemize that in your book, and you go through those discussions, and there's some other things that I thought actually you showed a lot of intellectual integrity by tossing out some of the weaker atheistic arguments, and this brings you to I don't know, does the experiment come first, or does the book on resurrection from Tom Wright?
I would say that the experiment comes first. first.
Okay, we got about, you know, 8 more minutes here, but tell us briefly what that is, and we'll play this out with Durham and Tom Wright and the rest.
Well, I come to the conclusion there was a first cause, and I had started to wrestle with the question of whether Christianity was true. Primarily, I think, because my mentor was Christian, and I thought, well, let me check out what he believes. Mm-hmm. He's a smart guy. Let me at least see what he believes. And one of the things that Christians believe is that this first cause is personal, that he interacts with us. And so as I was wrestling with the idea of whether Christianity was true, I hadn't really formulated the question, but I wanted to test it. And I picked up actually an idea that Moreland had mentioned about testing the idea of God being real and personal. And I thought, okay, I mean, I'm an English major kind of person, but I do have a kind of a scientific turn of mind. I like the idea of an experiment. And so I started talking with Josh, how would we kind of design an experiment? And he said, oh, okay, that sounds kind of cool. Mm-hmm. Let's try that. And so I was thinking, well, what would it mean if, if God is real, what can I expect from testing this? Well, I would get a sense of his presence. Okay, well, what's the failure conditions? Mm-hmm. Because if there's no failure conditions, how can it be a real test? Mm-hmm. And so we talked about whether I would have increased confusion. We talked about the fact that just because I didn't get a result didn't mean that it was a failed experiment.
Right.
Because we weren't talking about a machine. We're right. talking about a person.
Very important point that Lewis makes in his writings, too, you know, because the persons can just decide not to act.
Or I might not be able to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is we were still kind of working this out. Like, we were doing this by email, so there was a time lag. When I was coming home from work, I was going along the coast road. There's the Pacific Ocean to my right. And I realized that I was experiencing, well, what now I would say is the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
That I actually was encountering him, that I felt the presence of an other, capital O other, and that I recognized at a deep level that this presence was God.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really unnerving. I mean, it was no spectacular. I didn't see any visions. I didn't hear any voices. I just knew there was a presence. And the interesting thing is that, you know, as I've come to have a deeper relationship with Christ, I've encountered him in that way other times, in prayer, at the Eucharist, when praying for somebody else. And now I recognize the presence of the Holy Spirit, and he doesn't scare me, awes me, yes, scares me, no. But then just to feel this presence, this kind of weight, a sense that there was this other. It's really hard to explain. And if I try to explain to somebody who's not had this experience, I mean, you're imagining it.
Well, I think what's interesting about this, I mean, there's many levels of this, of interest on here. And, but one of them is that there's this very rich interplay between the affective and the cognitive, if you will. You know, you're thinking about these things, but things are happening on another level as well. But they're happening in concert with the ideas that you're knocking around and the cosmological argument and the other things that I mean, there's a lot more that you talk about in the book. You get Tom Wright's book in the Resurrection and Gary Habermas, that would be N.T. Wright, the Resurrection of the Son of God, and you is a cute little conversation. I mean, a little reflection there that here you're sitting in an airplane and you're reading a book with the word Jesus on the cover, you know, and it's like so unlike you. And somebody asks you if you're born again and you said, no. And, you know, end of conversation. So it's all, it's just very, very sweet. But, and again, in the interest of time, just a couple minutes here, you were deeply compelled by the evidence of the resurrection that Gary Habermas and Tom Wright had laid out in detail. And it brings you to a point of decision, if you will. And there's an interesting illustration that you use about buying a ticket and getting on an airplane. Can you give us a 60-second characterization of that?
I'll try. Well, one of the things I do want to just say that my experience encountering the Spirit in that way, I think is what made it impossible for me to not continue. Like, I had to continue looking into this because it mattered. He was real. This wasn't just an idea. I could not let it go.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I wanted to know, well, Christianity says, well, Christianity makes one major miracle claim. Yeah, healing. Yeah, whatever. That was what I thought at the time.
Mm-hmm.
the resurrection. And I thought, if the resurrection happened, then Christianity's true.
Mm-hmm.
And I went into a really full-fledged academic study, no holds barred. I mean, I have a PhD. I know how to do research.
Mm-hmm.
And what I discovered was, contrary to my expectations, I did not have to, quote-unquote, take this on faith.
Mm-hmm.
Historically, I was convinced that Jesus had claimed to be the Son of God, and that God vindicated that claim by raising him from the dead. And so I recognized that this was true. But the key point is, what am I going to do about it? And that was where I had a great conversation with my coach, because, you know, we were trying to find an analogy that would help me. How do I do this? Because I was recognizing that there was going to come a decision point, and I said, Josh, I don't know if I can do this. He said, yeah, you can. You will be able to. And he gave the analogy of that you can know that a plane will fly, but eventually you have to make the actual step of getting on board. It's not enough to just be intellectually convinced that you're not going to crash.
Right.
You've got to get on board. And so I finally decided it was true, and then I finally recognized that I would commit myself to Christ, mm-hmm. that I would make that choice of the will. And so the next time when I saw him at the tournament, I said, Josh, I bought the ticket.
In Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm. And then I got on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And oh, what a trip it's been since then. I thought I was done.
Right. No, I many listening along with me know exactly what you mean by that. Now, this is the time for this comment, though. We're going to return to it. And let's take the extra 2 minutes, all right, here. We already did. Okay. You mentioned that this book, in the beginning, it's not an account of how I came to love the Lord. That came later, after you became a Christian, in other words, and like the gift of knowing him came without my asking. Now, I actually think this is a profound observation and a very honest one, because it's very easy to for one to kind of enter into a stereotypical kind of Christian response to this, and everything's wonderful. But you learned that loving God was something you learned, and it was in the midst of a lot of difficulty too, because Jesus' yoke is easy, but it's also take up your cross.
Yes.
Do you want to say more about that?
I do. And I think one of the most important things I learned this from my pastors, was that to love is an action. And so to love Jesus means, first of all, to obey him, and to let go. And I will say that the moment that I actually experienced God's love for the first time was when I made my first sacramental confession.
Mm-hmm.
And my priest said, God's grace is real. Mm-hmm. And I walked out of the chapel, and I knew it. I felt, mm-hmm. God loved me. He does. And he died for me. And that was months after I was mm-hmm. baptized even.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think it's important to recognize this was hard. It was painful.
Well, you say that when you prayed to receive Christ, that was the first prayer that you had ever prayed in your entire life.
Yeah.
Talk about changes. Holly, it's been a treat talking with you today, and thank you for joining us and telling us your story.
Thank you so much.
It's Holly Ordway, Ordway, Moody Press has published Not God's Type. It's a quick read. I mean, I read it this morning. And I'm not a fast reader, but it flows nicely, and it's a lot of fun, and it'll be deeply encouraging to you as a follower of Christ. A rational academic finds a radical faith. That's great. Well, that's all the time we have for this day. By the way, hearing God's voice, should you be trying to find out how God may be speaking to you so you can find to make sure you do the right thing? Well, maybe not. That's my question in the featured article at str.org, so check it out. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. You go out and give them heaven this week. Bye-bye, friends.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts and radio program are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.